The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
But did anything go through your head at that moment? Was that you saying, right?
That was me saying, this is the first time he touched the ball in the final, and thank God I did something half decent with it.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Right, very welcome along. It's Tuesday morning to OTBAM, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. If you want to get involved this morning, 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. We're going to go to Newcastle and find out what exactly is happening on the ground there. Steve Bruce had an hour-long meeting with the new 10% owner yesterday and afterwards still had his job for the time being. Speculation this morning, Frank Lampard has suddenly vaulted to the top of the queue. He is available. He is big name. He's famous. He's had some success at bringing through some young talent. And he was the manager at the start of a season of a team who went on to win the Champions League. That's how I'm selling it, if I'm his agent. I mean, the team that he was managing at the start of the season, at the end of the season, was lifting that trophy. That's a good thing. And look, that's a winner-winner chicken dinner.
Look at Derby County now. As well, after he's left.
Exactly. So. That's another... When I left, they were going great guns. They were like promotion favourites the next season.
It doesn't matter that the promotion favourites didn't end up getting promoted under my watch, but I don't think they were promotion favourites under Lampard. But it will be very, very interesting to see what happens if he actually does get this job, because there is the possibility of a very comical scenario here where Frank Lampard is Newcastle manager and Newcastle get relegated. Like, I don't particularly dislike Frank Lampard or anything like that. I just think it would be objectively funny were that to happen. And that probably goes for any manager who comes into this newly minted football club. Were they to go down, it would be the funniest outcome from this Premier League season.
It was just this morning where I finally started to think about that. It's not a guarantee that no matter who they sign, really, that immediately the new manager is going to be able to bed in 5-6 signings mid-season. And, oh, their quality will be enough to keep them up. But what if it isn't?
Like, I have it down as 7 clubs who could potentially get relegated this season. And if we judge it by managers here, so you've got Sean Dyche over Burnley. I think there's enough wherewithal there to keep them up. You've got Bielsa at Leeds. I think Leeds are probably going to stay up. You've got Claudio Ranieri, obviously, at Watford. If you think that...
They're going down.
Okay, I was going to make a case for Ranieri, but it's a tough one to make. 2016 was a bizarre year. Let's not get away from that. But let's just play along with this for a moment. Dyche, Ranieri, Bielsa. Let's just set that experience that those three fellas have.
It gives them an advantage.
Might keep them up. Watford are a bad team, though, is obviously the problem there. So then you're hoping on Hasenhüttl, Farke and Vieira being worse managers than the Newcastle manager, and that those three clubs are the ones that get relegated before Newcastle United. Are they all definitely worse than Frank Lampard? I'm not so sure they are. So it could make for a very interesting few months. Now, the thing is, Newcastle will have a better squad than a lot of those players. And I think, as it stands, Newcastle have a better squad than at least three of those teams, especially in attacking areas. I think it's one of the things that's underrated a little bit about that squad. So that'll be the first job, is getting a tune from an OK team.
The next manager odds don't have Steve Bruce on them. Is there a world in which Steve Bruce yesterday, in that hour-long interview, convinced them that... You give me the money to sign these players, I will keep you up this season. Because let's face it, that's all they need to do. They just need to get to the next transfer window as a Premier League team. And then, sorry, not the next transfer window, but the next off-season as a Premier League team. And then all bets are off. Then you start to rebuild from whatever, and you get your fancy international manager who knows how to play better football than Steve Bruce does. That's when you make that change. Is there a possibility that... all this speculation is wrong, and that actually the right thing to do is let Steve Bruce sign 5 players for Manchester United, so at least he'll know which of the workshy layabouts should be run out of the club and which ones are really trying for the jersey. Is there any world where that happens?
Absolutely.
Then Brendan Rodgers might be tempted in the summer, but Brendan Rodgers ain't living now in the possibility of the team getting relegated.
No, and like the thing is, though, it's an attractive enough prospect if you do want to work with a club that's going to have a lot of cash, that you might think, okay, now's my chance to get it. And come the summer, Conte might be available, or whoever the competition is. So he might look at it like that. I still think maybe Brendan Rodgers, despite Leicester's mixed start to the season, is above that. I don't think he necessarily needs to jump on a job just yet. I think his stock will still be high at the end of the season, regardless of what happens with Leicester City. But yeah, I definitely think there's a possibility this happens, especially if it's a straight shootout between Steve Bruce and Frank Lampard. And as you say, there is the Lucien Favre connection at this point. There is an element of the risk about that then when Newcastle United look at him and say he hasn't managed in the Premier League. And sure, people in the Premier League get a little bit snobby about people who know the league and who've been there, done that. But I think if you're going to use that snobbishness and use that cliche, I think it kind of works with Steve Bruce to a point. And like the issue has been with Steve Bruce with a certain section of Newcastle fans over the last little while, but it's mostly been with Mike Ashley. And I think that there could be a situation where if Bruce starts to get a few results, it's Tottenham this weekend, then who knows, the stands might turn in his favour completely, and it could be an okay run to the end of the season. But I think that's best case scenario.
Okay, so what's your instinct? Who's going to be the next Newcastle manager?
I think it's really hard to call, and I think the Lampard connection does seem like it's gathering momentum over the last little while. And if I had to pick, I think it actually could be Lampard. I kind of hope it is, because as I say, it could be quite funny to see what happens. And you know what? It could be a redemption story. And there are some people who believe that there's no redemption needed for Frank Lampard, that he did a good job at Chelsea and he did a good job at Derby. But maybe if things go well for him at Newcastle United, we'll all be eating humble pie and saying, listen, he was a victim of his own success as a player and we wrote him off as a manager. So that there could be that narrative to it as well.
Or we'll be looking at him saying, look, it was just individual errors cost us in the end, and if we could just get rid of those, then we'd still be a Premier League team.
Like that could definitely be the situation as well. Like if you want to look through the odds and see who's actually favourite to get it, Brendan Rodgers is very much favourite at the moment, with Favre second favourite, Conte third favourite. Like Frank Lampard is an outsider when it comes to the odds at the moment.
What price?
16-1.
All right.
So probably what I'm saying here is completely off the mark. As you say, we're going to have Luke Edwards with us later on to give us a sense on who actually is going to be the front runner. Just when it comes to these sort of things, there can sometimes be a name mentioned like Lampard and they gather momentum and all of a sudden it becomes reality. So yeah. It's probably just a little bit of optimism from his perspective that actually he's the front runner.
Well, I don't know. I think it's the type of showy signing that new owners often try and make to placate the crowd. English football legend. And Alan Shearer might be a bit of a power broker in this. We'll get into that in a few minutes' time. Obviously, the Republic of Ireland are playing Qatar at Lansdowne Road in the Aviva tonight. We'll have full live commentary on it. Nathan Murphy and Stewie Byrne are calling it play-by-play. Caoimhín Kelleher is going to start the game in goals. Yesterday, it was confirmed that there won't be wholesale changes, but that was a fairly obvious one to make. You need to make sure that if Bazuna gets injured or loses form, that Caoimhín Kelleher has been given the opportunity to stake his claim. And I suspect that these two players are going to steal about 50 caps from each other over the next decade and a half, and they'll both end up with 120 caps. Is that possible?
Do you know what my prediction for Irish football is? That Mark Travers ends up becoming an absolute superstar as well, and that there may be another kid who comes along and is an absolute superstar as well, that Ireland becomes awash with three or four goalkeepers that are absolutely incredible, and it's not just going to be Kelleher or Bazunu. For the time being, we know that these two guys are going to the top. Possibly. They'll certainly be established Premier League goalkeepers within 3 years, I suspect. Kelleher, it seems that, because he was doing press yesterday, it seems that there's been some questioning about maybe the lack of luck that he's had in his career, the fact that Liverpool wanted to keep him because of injuries in the backup department to Alisson, and he couldn't get a loan move to the Netherlands. And then obviously he was injured and missed the first couple of internationals where Bazunu stakes his claim. And there's this tone of regret about Kelleher's career. Like I think that it's way too soon to be talking about any sort of regret when it comes to Caoimhín Kelleher. I think he's in a phenomenal place in his career, and there is every chance that he gets the number one jersey for Ireland. Like even if you compare it with the England number one shirt over the last little while, granted they've been a basket case at times in the pre-Southgate era, but that's been a very volatile thing, the number one jersey for England. Now granted that's been down to a lot of a loss of form from the likes of Joe Hart and injuries here and there, but the goalkeeper position is not always a sure thing when it comes to international football. It changes from time to time, and I think over the next couple of years we'll be very thankful that we do have two goalkeepers at least who are top quality, who are destined to be top quality. And I don't think, like, I mean, he missed out on a couple of caps in the context of 2021. I don't think anything that's happened to Caoimhín Kelleher has stalled his development in the context of his career as a whole. And I'm just excited that we're going to see him for his second cap tonight.
Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. We're going to talk to Stephen Hunt immediately. We'll get into that in a bit more detail as well. Luke Edwards from The Telegraph is going to join us to talk to us about the latest situation at Newcastle. We've got the sports pages for you at 8:15. Going to join Will O'Callaghan for an update on the sports news as well. We've got boxing with Ronan Mullen, looking at the power ranking of the heavyweights as it stands at the moment. Anthony Moyle is going to join us at 9:05 to talk to us about the situation in Meath, but also the possibility about what looks like is coming down the tracks ultimately is going to be a round robin provincial system. So they're going to take the hurling system and apply it to football. That's the latest speculation. John Fogarty's talking about that today in the Irish Examiner, which will mean that there'll be a brilliant province in the Ulster province, a brilliant competition there, and their other three will be deadweight. That's what's going to happen. And then Kevin Kilbane's thoughts on the Republic of Ireland at 9:30 this morning. But it is 7:40. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Stephen Hunt is with us. Good morning to you, Stephen. How are you?
Morning, guys. How are you doing?
On the scale of the former Republic of Ireland internationals who are like, just kicked the ball long, versus the hang on a second now, let's give the manager a chance. Where are you? Where's the Stephen Hunt pendulum swinging at the moment?
Listen, I think before the night's game, I would say for Stephen Kenny's point of view, he needed a win. So whatever it takes to get the win on the night, I'd say it was important. I am right in the middle of it. I think we can play good football and we can keep our old mentality of being stubborn and hard to beat. If we can find that right mix, I'd be a very happy guy. But I was very pleased with the team's performance the other day. I thought it was very good. And to answer your question, Ger, I'm right in the middle of it.
Are you seeing signs of progress or enough signs of progress at this stage?
Yes. I've always said, Ger, 4 years is the turnaround for this team to change its style of play and to start winning games. Like any coach, if you were going into pre-season and you were in a club side and you had 6 games in pre-season to express your style, it'd be very hard. So it was always going to take quite a few games to get it right. He has been very unlucky, I have to say, with COVID and COVID pullouts over the period of time. And for the style of play we tried to play, I can see good patterns, I can see good movement. And I think the other night was a justified performance first and foremost, and result obviously good enough, more than likely, fingers crossed for Stephen, it keeps him in a job.
Well, you talked to us a bit about the shape of the team and what you're seeing, because particularly midfield at the moment. So Nathan was on last night saying that he thinks that the midfield are being exposed a little bit by the reluctance of the defenders in particular to push up, and so that's leaving the big space. It ends up being the midfielders who are caught on the turn and who look like they're not doing what they're supposed to do, but actually that's as much a function of the defenders not pushing up and squeezing that space as it is the defence or the midfielders being overrun.
Yeah, well, our first goal did our night come from John Egan stepping in on the halfway line and winning it there. Now, the other night, we looked a little bit vulnerable for the first time on the counter-attack in midfield, in midfield areas. Normally, Josh Connell does a very good job of that, and he normally sits tight and keeps his shape. I think once you have the back three with that formation, the back three and the two midfielders are key. But Jeff Hendricks was very good at coming out of his space and winning the ball back up. I think the intensity the other night was bang on. The desire to win the ball back high up the pitch was clear to see, because it leaves you a little bit weak in certain situations. But I thought the centre-halves, Dentman did very well, Omadeli and John Egan especially, coming out of their slots and winning the ball back. So I thought we looked a little bit vulnerable. We'll be keen to address that and take it from there.
The function of playing wing backs on both sides, it kind of necessitates that the attackers drop in, play a little bit more narrow. From your perspective as a winger, Stephen, does that sometimes lessen your impact or lessen what you can do as an attacker? And I'm talking about the players playing either side of Ida.
Yeah, I think the two boys playing from either side of Ida did very well the other day in terms of coming into pockets of space. If they had come out off their slots and come into little pockets, and James McLean and Matt Doherty were wide. If Matt Doherty and James McLean had come into little spaces, which I thought they'd done very well the other night, the two other guys would go wide. So I generally thought there was a good mix in terms of movement, in terms of shape from wide areas and inside. The two centre forwards, as in the two wingers coming inside, literally are nearly centre forwards now, done a very good job that night. Even, I'm not too sure why Dal Horgan was taken off, whether it was an injury or tactical. I thought he was good as well, and very unlucky if he was taken off on the basis of playing wise. So I was really impressed with them. And as I said, they were a little bit vulnerable on the counter-attack, but I think they'll be keen to address that now and make sure they have hold them. I think against better opposition, they'll go, maybe Jeff Hendricks will drop out and a more defensive-minded player might come into the team and play to hold them. Because if we played against better opposition on the counter-attack, we would have got done the other night for sure.
Daryl Horgan's come in for a bit of flack in the aftermath of Saturday. So could you explain what you saw in his performance that was positive?
Yeah, Daryl Horgan is an explosive player. I've seen him play a load of times. I think the best word for Daryl Horgan is he's effective. He gets crosses in when he can. I didn't think he deserved to be taken off. I thought he did well. Maybe we were obviously two goals up or whatever we were at the time, and we wanted to tighten the ship a little bit with Jamie McGrath. But I actually thought he had a good game in terms of his movement, in terms of link-up play. And I know the manager likes him, and he's done it before, Stephen. He's made substitutions at half-time. He's not afraid to, and take it from there. Stephen would be a better one to tell you why he did it in terms of a tactical point of view. But I thought he did okay in the game, and he come inside, did good link-up, and I'm sure going forward. I thought James McLean was excellent in both sides of his defending, from a full-back and from an attacking point of view, he was good as well.
In the away game against Portugal, it might have been about players' availability, but we did actually play with Hendrick. He did start, and I'm pretty sure it was Jamie McGrath. It was Jamie McGrath and Hendrick. Yeah. What does McGrath give you that's a bit different from what Daryl Horgan gives you?
Yeah, I think he plays central midfield for his club in Scotland and St Mirren, and he gets goals from there, and he gets in the box. From Ireland's point of view, he plays off wide one and he comes inside quite a bit, so he gives you that option infield to gain possession and keep control of possession. I think he's a very good technical footballer. I think he's actually better from the left than he is from the right. If he's going to play in a wide area, I've seen him play a couple of times with Dundalk, he can play more fluently from the left than he does on the right, but he's definitely a technical player. He's playing in a physical league up there. He'll probably prosper from coming to a better footballing team. Having said that, Jim Goodwin and St Mirren have done a very good job. My old Waterford friend has done a very good job of managing the team up there and plays good football, so in a physical league. So listen, Jamie McGrath, I'm sure, is a technical player and will improve Ireland with the ball 100%.
We were talking about number 10s on the show. Is there room for Alan Brown to play a kind of advanced eight in this side, or has the team gone a slightly different direction over the last 6 months since Brown has kind of been unavailable at various ages across the way?
I think you can really play with the back three, and the two in midfield will always be, I suppose, say straight on the map. They're down, they're playing this way. But then you can allow yourself against weaker teams to play with one in midfield if you want, with two in front, and then two wide players as wide as you can. So a 4-2-3-1 necessarily. And then that's where Brown comes into play, because he does look to get a goal from midfield. He's very good in the air and can be an absolute box-to-box player and cover more ground. So he is a good option to have. Stephen has good options going forward from now on. And he hopefully gets over this patch of question marks and the FAI come out in certain times and say, right, listen, they're part of the next 2 years. Give him the Euros and see where we go. So, listen, I was always saying 4 years is a minimum. When Wales did their transition into a playing side football team, they took a while to get the balance right and take it from there.
So, you think, just for the avoidance of doubt, Stephen Kenny should be given the Euros?
Yes, I think the performance and from the start, I'm not saying the results have been good enough, but I think from the start of his regime, I always said 4 years was going to take, and I expected the young boys to take him to bed in, start getting results. I think you can see a clear pattern of play. And one thing I would give Stephen credit for, he's stuck to his guns. He's not gone and said, right, okay, I need the result, I'm going to boot it long. He's going to die his way by playing football. And the other night they got a result. I have to say, Azerbaijan played a game that was quite expansive for a lower ranked team. That helped us. I think a lower ranked team normally parks the bus and tries to break us down. I tried to break them down, and we had lots of room there to play. If you get to be even against Qatar tonight, how will they play? Will they close up shop and see how we break them down from there? So there'll be different challenges ahead for Stephen and how to break down lower block teams, and that'll be the key for us, I think.
You mentioned James McLean there earlier, Stephen, and his performances recently for the Republic of Ireland have been really, really good. And I think we kind of need to remember that he's still only 32, that it's not a sort of final sting in his career at all. This is just another peak in his career from an Irish perspective anyway. So what are you seeing from somebody who would have played in a relatively similar position, at least in the international setup, from what he's doing under Stephen Kenny?
Quite a lot, actually. I think the new formation helps James. I think he's able to come onto the ball more. He's able to see things earlier from his position he's in, and that gives him an allowance to bomb forward and then obviously get back as well. I think his energy levels at the night were very good. I think his positional sense, he was in the right area defensively. He made decisions to come inside and block the ball off from going outside him. His decision-making was excellent the other night, and his energy levels will always be good for Ireland. He set us off right from the first minute, but he slows him down. And listen, if I was playing now and I was looking at James, I'd be saying I'd be delighted to play in that position. The final third is a little bit different because you've got to be a bit more explosive. He's still fit enough, of course, but that explosiveness you lose as you get older. But for James now to have this chance to play in that role, he's grabbed it with both hands. And I'd imagine maybe Enda Stevens, like for like, would probably play tonight, but I think James, if it was a competitive game, would keep his place.
And what makes that position so fascinating then is when Seamus Coleman comes back, you can throw Matt Doherty into that debate for that one position as well. Is there a way in which you can get two of that three on the pitch at the same time at all, assuming Coleman is your right wing back?
Listen, Seamus Coleman is the ultimate pro and leads by example. I think you got to put Matt and Seamus in the same position. If Matt can play centre half, he can. Omadeli, I think the biggest compliment I can give him is that you've hardly noticed him in the games. He's made some good blocks at times, and then also he's just got on with his job. And for a young pro, he's been very mature in his way. And it'll be hard to take them out of the team the way they played the back three. I thought they were excellent the other night. Yes, against lower opposition, but you've still got to do your job and play well.
In Caoimhín Kelleher's press conference yesterday, he was asked about the opportunity he had as a Liverpool player to go out on loan to the Dutch league and how Liverpool wanted to keep him as a result of a few events at the club. We've spoken a lot on the show about Josh Cullen and the experience that he's getting in the Belgian league. From your own experience as an agent, Stephen, how live a possibility is this now becoming for a lot of these Irish players, the fact that the Premier League and the Championship is no longer the be-all and end-all and that the continent is a real opportunity for players to develop?
Yeah, listen, I think the football world of Ireland and England is beginning to realise that there's soccer, football abroad, just as big fans, bigger fans maybe in some cases, and it's good to go abroad and play. Everybody will always be attracted to Premier League because of the full stadiums. That'll always be the number one destination over time, but certainly in young players' careers, to go abroad now and play is not as late. Most countries, once they speak English, and they're able to, it all depends on the character of the lads going away as well. If they like company, then sometimes it can be difficult if they don't speak the language you're there. So I think Irish players can go abroad. To answer Kelleher's question, I think for him to go and compete with Gavin, he'll have to play over time. Unfortunately for both of them, they've got really good keepers in Man City and Liverpool. It'll be difficult, but I can see them, sorry guys, I can see them definitely playing first team football for both clubs over time, but only time will tell how good they get.
There was an injury doubt over Horgan, and there is a concern over Josh Cullen as well. So give us your preferred team for tonight. We know Caoimhín Kelleher is going to start in goals, and we know that there won't be wholesale changes, but if there's injury doubts about anybody, it is a friendly, and while a result is important and it's a sellout essentially in terms of the amount that they're allowed to have tonight, it's 25,000 for a Qatar game. It's good going. So, who do you want to see play?
I think Stephen would be keen not to have a dull game. I'm honest with you, I think it's a very important game for the team. I think he'll do like-for-like changes in terms of personnel. I think he'll keep the same formation, the same kind of attack-minded format. I think so. Andy Stevens will come in maybe for James, who doesn't need to play. I think he's done enough. You don't need to see him. I think Matt Doherty will probably remain right wing back. The front three, I think Adam will play again. Maybe Troy will play off one of them. Listen, I'm trying to think who else can play in the front three. But
stick Aaron Connolly in and try and get him some game time and remind everybody at Brighton what they're missing out on.
I think Connolly's had game time. I think he's got to be patient now and wait for his opportunity. Listen, he might play tonight. I think when he does play next, I think Aaron Connolly's got to bring an intensity to the whole situation. I think he does. I think he was very unlucky against Portugal. He had a lot of just if moments. If he could actually get the ball in the net or actually had a pass away, he'd have been not far from a very good performance because his positioning was really good. And I think tonight, Qatar will probably sit back deeper and it'll be up to us to break us down. The one thing I would say is that when teams come out and attack us, we look very good. When teams sit back, we'll have to find a way of breaking them down, and Stephen will then have to say, OK, can we move the ball quicker? It's almost like a bigger team playing at home in the Premier League when a Burnley goes and sits in. Can you break them down over time? You stick to the way you're playing and they'll get deeper and deeper and you'll score. So I think it's a big game for Stephen tonight. I think the intensity of the Irish fans will want us to do well. Credit to the Irish fans that actually went abroad the other day and the 200 so that were there. I think it was nice for them to be there and witness a good win.
Yeah, no, fair play.
Could I just ask you, Stephen, what would your advice be to Aaron Connolly in terms of his club future?
Listen, I don't know the lad, so it's very difficult to say, but one thing I would say is that he's in with a very good manager. He's on the fringes of the first team. Get your head down, play. He won't be allowed to go out on loan, I'd imagine, this season. I think he'll be in and around the squad. Get in there, get your place. Concentrate on football, I would say, for any young player I would speak to is keep your focus. And listen, the one thing I would say is when Galway get a superstar, they sing from the rooftops about him. They haven't done that on this occasion on Aaron. So Aaron needs to get himself focused on football, play well, and then let everything else come to him.
All right, Stephen, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us today. Cheers.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Stephen Hunt giving us his thoughts there on the Republic of Ireland against Qatar tonight and the performance at the weekend. That game is live this evening. It is Nathan Murphy and Stewie Byrne on commentary duty for you. You'll hear that from 7 o'clock on Off the Ball on News Talk. It is 7:57. Time for us to turn our attention to the takeover at Newcastle and what happens next. Luke Edwards of The Telegraph is with us. Luke, you're away from the Ireland beach just as it's starting to get interesting. All those years watching the team play bad football. Oh, were you? Ah, very good.
I was thinking about this the other day that I was there for the Euros in 2016, which was a little bit better than what's happening now. But yeah, it seems to have turned a bit of a corner to Stephen Kenny. I'm really pleased for him.
We're back.
And long may it continue. I haven't been over for ages. I haven't been over since 2019, right. Which is obviously partly to do with the pandemic. And partly to do with the fact that Ireland have not been very good. So we haven't been sending, but hopefully that will change. I do miss Dublin. I'm not sure whether the Irish media pack are particularly missing me, of course. But
we miss you, Luke. That's what matters.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm really pleased for him, and it's really, really, really interesting to see how that unfolds over the coming months.
It turns out your local beat has got a bit saucier and a bit more interesting too.
Yes, it has. Yeah. So I live in Castle and over in England, and this is has been my patch for 20 years, and suddenly I'm covering the richest club in the world. So happy days. I should be quite so flip about that, really, because obviously there are concerns about the Saudi Arabian owners, and I think we always have to be mindful of that. But I think for the time being, and I think I will be mindful of that whenever I'm reporting on the club, moving forward, I will always be mindful of those human rights issues and who the owners are and what the regime are. But for now, I don't think anyone can, no one would really begrudge, not really, Newcastle supporters being overjoyed. And most of that joy is about Mike Ashley leaving. But they've got their club back. That's how it feels. The city is absolutely buzzing. And Sunday's game against Tottenham is going to be some occasion. It really will.
You've been reporting today about the possibility of Frank Lampard being in the mix for the managerial job. We were just chatting about this a little bit earlier on. Is there a world in which Steve Bruce is given the job until the end of this season and allowed to see out the year for fear of the upheaval that a new manager and five or six signings in the winter transfer window will have? Or is that pie in the sky?
I think it's pie in the sky, and I was having this conversation with somebody yesterday. If Newcastle had held on at 2-1 in injury time against Southampton, and if they had converted one of their many, many chances against Watford, and they had four more points on the board, and they weren't in the relegation zone, so two wins out of seven, and a few couple of, and a draw, that would have been a decent enough return. And then I think in that scenario, perhaps they could have just kept Bruce on, because there wouldn't have been quite the same level of animosity towards him, and the league situation wouldn't look quite so dire. And then I think that would have actually bought them a bit of time. And there is a lot of pressure on them now already, the new owners, to get this new managerial appointment right. So Frank Lampard's name is in the mix. Lucien Favre's, the former Borussia Dortmund manager's name is in the mix. But they've taken over a football club that they didn't think they were going to get until next year at the earliest, the consortium. So they've come in. There's a lot of names in the air. I don't even really think they've hardened up a short list of who the manager will be. So it's all a little bit chaotic at the moment. And that's really the sense I've had over the last sort of 72 hours, is just how chaotic it is. There's a lot of people trying to make their voices heard in and around the consortium, let alone in it. They've obviously got three directors, the chairman from PIF, Amanda Staveley and Jamie Rubin. They all have people advising them. So it's a little bit chaotic at the moment. But no, I think Bruce will go this week. And I think that clean break is probably the right thing to do, because he is so unpopular, so disliked, that I think it would just sour the sort of feel-good factor a little bit if he was to come out or lead the team out of the dugout against Tottenham. It's a little bit sad for Steve Bruce, because he's done a job that he was wanting, the old owner needed him to do. And without Steve Bruce keeping Newcastle in the Premier League for the last 2 years, and they could easily have gone down, and lots of people said they would go down. He's facilitated this transfer going through, and I'm sure he would have liked to crack it off, you know, working for different owners at his boyhood club and the job he'd always wanted. But no, I think they'll have to bring in a new manager. And I'm of all the names that have come to me, the more I think about it, Frank Lampard makes some sense to me, because they need somebody who knows the Premier League. He's a young manager. He's a big name. He has pulling power because of his name as a manager. He can grow into the job, but he's not that elite level manager. He's got a point to prove. He would take the job if it was offered to him. I'm absolutely sure about that. And they need to make a swift appointment. And I think Frank Lampard actually ticks a lot of the boxes. You can throw Eddie Howe's name into there. I think they'll go for a manager who's out of work, just because it speeds up the process and becomes a lot less complicated. But we shall see. They haven't even finalised or hardened up who they're going to go for yet. So as I say, it's all a little bit chaotic. But I think they'll appoint a manager in the next 10 days, 2 weeks, I would hope.
In the here and now, Luke, who is a better manager, Steve Bruce or Frank Lampard?
Oh, what a question. Well, Steve Bruce has a proven track record of getting teams out of relegation. He's also suffered some relegations. I'm sure Newcastle fans who are listening to this would scream at me as those words came out of my mouth. But he has kept Newcastle up for 2 years with this squad. And, you know, the chance for him to be able to improve the squad in January, you would expect he would be the safer, really, if I'm being honest, he'd be the safer bet. But it's just gone to the point of no return with Newcastle United supporters, rightly or wrongly. It's been building up for 2 years. And Frank Lampard would come in with a clean slate. And I think the job, I'm sort of avoiding the question there, defining it. I think I would be happier if Steve Bruce was manager in terms of keeping Newcastle up. But having said that, I think Frank Lampard did a far better job at Chelsea than he's given credit for, actually. I think, yes, Tuchel came in and won the Champions League with that same group of players. But we also have to remember the job that Frank Lampard did in his only full season there, which was take a squad, a very, very young squad, blooded a lot of these young players who Tuchel has developed and improved, and got them in the Champions League. So it wasn't exactly a disastrous start when he was sacked. He was just a victim of what Chelsea are, and they have probably got the most ruthless owner in European football in terms of changing and chopping managers as soon as results dip. So he's got a point to prove. Yes, it's a risk. Of course it's a risk to point to someone like Frank Lampard. And I'm not saying it's definitely going to be Frank Lampard. It could go for Eddie Howe, but Eddie Howe took Bournemouth now. So all these managers that they're realistically able to get, they've all got black marks on their CV, because that's the nature of where they are. Even though they've got new owners, Newcastle are 19th in the Premier League, second from bottom. They're not going to be a lure, really, an attractive proposition for the really elite-level managers. So they're going to have to go and get somebody with a point to prove, who's had a bit of failure in their career and a bit of a flaw. And I just like Frank Lampard. I think he just ticks a lot of the boxes for what they need at this particular time.
Well, he's certainly going to bring attention, and he's going to take everybody away from the ownership, and people will start talking about him and talking about the football again. So there's a big win there, as opposed to even somebody from abroad who might be better qualified, because at that point, it's just there's less of a an emotional tie to the manager than there will be for somebody who is a national hero like Lampard. Can I just ask you as well about the chaos behind the scenes? I totally understand that this has happened much quicker, and so that's how the business works. Presumably they have some idea who they want to run football operations, who isn't the manager, a transfer policy, anything like that. Is there any sense that somebody will be a steady hand on the tiller in terms of the type of footballer that they're going to buy? Because the transfer speculation this week is off the charts.
Yeah, I think Frank McPartland is involved. He was in recruitment at Liverpool, Watford, Burnley, Glasgow Rangers, vastly experienced. I think he's working for them in some capacity already. I think he may get some sort of role in recruitment because obviously along with the manager, that is, as you've just said, that is the, you know, they've got to plan for the January window, so they need someone to be doing that now. We're heading into mid-October, aren't we? So there isn't that long to get a list of targets, and I think that it is chaotic. Yeah, I think he could come in terms of a sporting director, director of football. Again, a bit like the manager, there isn't anything concrete in place. There's a lot of names circulating, a lot of people pushing different people. I think the manager will come in before the director of football and the CEO, the new CEO that they want. Again, those two appointments really are probably arguably bigger than the manager long term, because they're going to be in charge of running the football club, including, you know, assessing the manager in the future. But they need to get a manager in now. They can't let this drift. They can't just have a caretaker manager for 3, 4, 5 games in Graham Jones, because you could easily be cut adrift. And the pressure is on. I keep saying that, but the pressure is on. They've got to get this decision right, because if they don't, they're going to be the richest club in the Championship next season. And that is a real danger. This squad has fought against relegation for 4 years since promotion back to the Premier League. It's never been clear of the, particularly clear of the drop zone until the end of the season, or comfortably clear of the drop zone until the end of the season. So it's a limited group of players, and they need someone who's going to come in, lift everybody, but also has that knowledge of the Premier League straight away. So I think they've got to go for a manager of Premier League experience. I really do.
Is Brendan Rodgers a real contender at this point, or is he the type of person who'll wait and see exactly how things shake out and make sure that the director of football is somebody he can work with, make sure that the chief executive is somebody he could work with?
Yeah, I think that's a really good assessment. If I was Brendan Rodgers, I would be tempted. I really would, because it's just beginning. He's going through his first difficult spell at Leicester, isn't he? Vardy's not getting any younger. He's kind of won the FA Cup with Leicester. There is a sort of question, perhaps, can he do anything more with them? Or, you know, and he's having this sticky spell. But I think that, like a lot of managers, they will want to see how the cards fall, how this shapes up. I think he might be tempted. That name has been circulated. I think he might be tempted, but probably just a little bit soon for him, I would have thought, to leave Leicester, where he's got good owners, good infrastructure, a good squad, and sort of jump at the first sign of a sticky patch to go to Newcastle. I don't know. I wouldn't rule him out entirely. Certainly wouldn't rule him out entirely for all the reasons I've just said. I think he would be tempted, but I think it might just be a bit too soon even for someone like him.
I have one last one. The arrival of big money into any club has traditionally seen that club splurge wildly in the transfer window and not really get value for money. So my favourite one yesterday was Manchester United might be willing to offload Lingard, Bailly, Van de Beek and Martial in some kind of buy four for the price of three deal. And I presume everybody else in the Premier League is looking at this going, oh yeah, you can definitely have my reserve team players.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, actually, although the four players you've just mentioned at Manchester United, they would all still vastly improve Newcastle from where they are. So, a lot of players would improve Newcastle from where they are in terms of the squad they've got. So yeah, they're going to have to be. It's interesting because they can spend 190 million under the terms of financial fair play rules because of the lack of spending under Mike Ashley. So that's a hell of a lot of money. But I do notice immediately that has emerged into the public domain. There has been a definite pushback from the new owners, suggesting that they won't be spending anything like that amount of money in January, which suggests that they're already very conscious of the fact that if they're going to go to these clubs, they're going to get ripped off. January is not a great window to do business in anyway. You always have to pay a little bit over the odds in January to get your main targets. But they're going to have to be wary of that sort of thing, and then sort of plan accordingly. I don't think they'll get anywhere near to 190 million in January. I think they'll probably come out and make that point publicly before the window opens, just to guard against all the things you've just mentioned. Because, you know, you can waste a lot of money very, very quickly in recruitment if you just sort of don't plan it and don't think it through. But they definitely need new signings. I mean, I would say they need at least 5 new players in January, which is a lot to do in 1 month.
And we are very excited here to see Jeff Hendrick keep Donny van de Beek out of the team and Kieran Clark keep Eric Bailly out of the team. It's going to be great to see in the second half of the season. Luke, just one final thing. The arc, I mean, this is a very speculative question, but the arc of this club towards the expectation that they will challenge for Champions League places, how many years do you think it'll take? Do you think it'll be a slower build than Manchester City, for example?
I would give it 10 years, personally. Right. I mean, I really would. I don't think you should be expecting Champions League football. I mean, I know Amanda Savely talks about between 5 and 10 years. Now, the problem for anybody when you say that and the way the media work is everybody reported within 5 years winning Premier Leagues. And I don't think it will be that quick. But who knows? The Saudis, they did not buy this football club to bob around in mid-table. So they may well get impatient. They don't want to. They're probably not going to want to hear 10 years. So, a lot is going to depend on them, ultimately. It's their football club, really, despite all the shenanigans about separation. The Saudi Arabia football club, the public investment fund football club. So it will be very interesting to see. I think they'll want to certainly be in Europe within the next sort of 3 or 4 years, I would guess. And then you try and win a trophy first, whether that's the Premier League. I don't think it really matters. Man City won the FA Cup first, didn't they? I seem to remember. So Newcastle won a domestic trophy since 1955. So I think those things are possibly achievable in sort of 4, 5, 6 years. And I think that will be the kind of time scale. But it is more difficult now. There's more top teams. There's more elite teams. It's not the same as when Chelsea and Manchester City did it, because you've already got Chelsea and Manchester City ahead of you now. So I think it will be tentative at first. And they'll talk a lot about long term. Then eventually, at some point, I suspect the Saudis will intervene and say, right, we want to get this ball rolling properly now. And we want to win things, because they don't want a mid-table Premier League football club. That's kind of pointless thing for them.
Luke, we've got to let you go, but is Alan Shearer involved somewhere? Is it just an ambassadorial role he has?
I think he will be. I think he'll take an ambassadorial role and advise them a little bit. I think that will happen probably initially in a sort of informal, ad hoc basis. But I think at some point, once he can sort of marry that with his other work commitments, I don't think he wants to stop doing Match of the Day over here, for example. So I think at some point that will be formalised. But I think that makes sense, because the one thing they lack is local knowledge. And there's nobody knows Newcastle United better than Alan Shearer, having spent more than a decade there playing as club record goal scorer and grown up in the city. So that is a very sensible decision for me.
Luke, great to have you back. Thanks a million. Cheers.
See you soon. Take care. Cheers. Bye.
It's Luke Edwards of The Telegraph there, giving us his thoughts on the situation at the takeover of Newcastle by the Saudi Arabia, essentially. I think we can all agree that that's what's happened there. And it's going to be that constant tension. How much do you talk about the human rights abuses? How much do you talk about murdered journalists and LGBTQ rights? And how much do you talk about Donny van de Beek potentially going as part of a blockbuster 100 million deal?
When you mentioned Brendan Rodgers there, he will go from a place of winning the FA Cup, where he picked up the owner and spun him around on the field, cradled in his arms, to a club run by Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, where I suspect that, yes, there might be more FA Cup trophies hanging in the trophy cabinet in Newcastle in 10, 15 years' time, but there will be fewer dances with the owners, I suspect, on the pitch. He's gone from a wholesome situation to a less wholesome situation, or he would do were he to take this job.
Yeah, unless the owners end up becoming quite public over a period of time, and that's how this whole thing works.
But they're not, unless, you know, maybe the PIF really is separate and the chairman of the PIF just turns out to be a good guy, and that's what we see all the time. Whether or not we're going to see Bin Salman there,
if you're Man United, though, you're looking at all the turkeys in the dressing room going, right, I can just bundle you all together and get you off my wage bill, and I can have 4 of my kids come in and play 15-20 games this season, and I can take my 100 million in cash and bank that. And then this summer there are a lot of strikers available in the transfer window. What do I do?
Yeah, you look at that and it's like an interesting time to be having this conversation because Manchester United might well have to start with Phil Jones and Eric Bailly this weekend, and they've already got rid of Axel Tuanzabe to Aston Villa for this season. So they've done a bit of damage in that. The injury has actually come to fruition. These players may actually have to play. Like one thing, like you said, is that like McFred have been available and Pogba has been relatively available, that we actually haven't seen Van de Beek needed as much as maybe he was signed to be. So like maybe Manchester United look around at their squad depth and say some of these players are genuinely our next man up and they need to make signings that actually replace them too.
Yeah, so maybe they are next man up and that's what frightens me, and that's why I'm taking, you know, 50 cents on the dollar now, cashing in and buying better young players, younger players,
yeah,
who are squad players and who are announced as squad players, as opposed to somebody gets a full page ad in a newspaper from his leaving club because he's so good and so special. I'm kind of vaguely surprised that Ajax didn't retire Donny van de Beek's jersey. They loved him so much. But it's been one of the most underwhelming signings in the history of English football. And if anybody's offering you any money for that right now, you're like, oh yeah. I mean, no matter what Solskjaer says in public, they must be like, can we get any of this money back? Can we? Can you give me any money for this?
It would make, yeah, it would be a win for everybody involved, because you suspect that that full page ad in the, I don't know, the Amsterdam Observer or whatever it was is... oh no, sorry, it was in the Manchester Evening News. It was in the English press, sorry. That's probably worth something still. And Van de Beek, you could still get a handsome enough fee for him. And from Van de Beek's perspective, he'll definitely feel
that he's... plays some football.
Yeah, and he's good at football. I mean, that's why you take out a full page ad, isn't it?
Do we know he's good at football? Are we sure?
I judge my footballers by the size of the ads, not by the size of their talent.
OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to hear from Ronan Mullen talking boxing, Anthony Moyles about the Mead situation, which looks now like it's edging back in favour of Andy McEntee, and also about the GAA scenario, where it looks like we're heading for not Plan B, which would actually be brilliant, at least for experimental phase. We could have 3 years of experiments and see what it looks like, but no, that looks like that's not going to happen. But up next, this morning's back pages. OTB AM. Right, 18 minutes past 8, we can run you through the newspapers here on OTB AM this morning. Ireland versus Qatar, the starting 11, Stephen Kenny should go with. That's from Team OTB. We've got Kenny unhappy with long process for Cork native Ogbeni's eligibility. Is Josh Cullen Ireland's best central midfielder since Roy Keane? Ireland under Stephen Kenny are laboured and hard to watch. That was Caban last night, and the latest on the Mendy trial, refused bail as he awaits trial for rape and sexual assault. So you can see that the stories are all about the Republic of Ireland at the moment. Back page of the Irish Independent this morning. Kelleher ready for centre stage. That's Kevin Kelleher making a save in training, and Lampard and Favre in toon sights. This is going to be difficult, isn't it?
How did you pronounce Brett's name?
Well, is it exactly the same, though?
Probably not.
Is he from the Midwest, or where's Brett Favre from?
I don't know where he's from. But
the R comes before the V in Favre.
It's spelled differently, is it?
No, it's not.
Oh, it's spelled the same?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but sorry, in pronunciation, yeah, Favre. Favre. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Favre. There's something about Mary joke that you didn't straight over your head.
Yeah, well, no, I've seen something about Mary.
Well, there's a whole bit in it about pronunciation of Brett Favre's name.
Oh god, those holes in
obviously
my brain
really landed
appearing once again.
It really landed.
He's from Mississippi, Brett Favre, so I'm not sure does that feed into the pronunciation. Lucien is not from there.
No. So there's a picture of Prince Andrew on the front of the London Times, and you kind of I'm going to just read this now, because like
if you hear a silence on this show, chances are jurors got distracted by the front page of the Daily Telegraph or the London Times featuring Prince Andrew.
Radical plan to save games no one wants. This is the Commonwealth Games. Do you know, if we rejoin the Commonwealth, we win loads of medals at the Commonwealth Games. If you were in Fine Gael, that's one of the things you would do to sell the Commonwealth, isn't it? Think of all the medals we could win at major championships like the Commonwealth Games, which is so crap that even the people who are involved in it don't want it to happen anymore.
I'm astonished to see that headline. I did not know that was the British view of the Commonwealth Games. I thought the Commonwealth Games were like their All-Ireland Championship. And it turns out, no, even the London Times are stabbing their great sporting tradition in the back.
They're like some kind of jubilee that they have to celebrate 50th anniversary of some great act of colonisation. A radical bid to protect the future of the Commonwealth Games will result in the number of compulsory sports being cut from 16 to 2. Athletics and swimming with host cities allowed to significantly reduce the number of more traditional sports in an effort to increase appeal and drive down costs. They're like, yeah, you can have a Fortnite competition, you can have skateboarding, you can have whatever, you can have basketball, you can do cool things as opposed to the normal sports that would have been in the Commonwealth Games, like boxing. Loads of Irish people have won Commonwealth Games medals in the past. But anyway, and there's Amanda Staveley and her husband, who are 10% shareholders in the Saudi Arabian takeover of Newcastle. That picture is on the back page of all the papers. The Telegraph have it as well. And there's an interesting column from Jason Burt saying being the first manager might not be the best gig. So you want somebody to come in to Newcastle, take the gig, keep them safe, and then get fired in the summer because they're not showbiz enough. And then you take over. Lampard and Favre in frame for Newcastle. That's Luke Edwards' piece. We've just been talking to Luke. And Mason Mount got the jab. He's vaccinated against COVID because during the Euros, you might remember, he missed a game and he had to sit out and he missed a game against Scotland. And so he's out of the team. And so he decided the best thing for him was to make sure that that wouldn't happen again. And so he didn't let the virus take caps from him. He decided he was going to get the jab and so give himself every chance of playing in games. And so he wasn't going to let the virus take caps from him. Because it's not the virus that's taking the caps from you. It's the absence of the jab that's taking the caps from you. That was Mason Mount's logic. As a footballer, he was able to work that out.
It was the aftermath of the Scotland game, wasn't it? When he was chatting to Billy Gilmour. And their
the
arms
aftermath
are,
yeah, yeah. It was the next game he missed, yeah. Down but not out, RG Snyman vows to go again after a nightmare cruciate diagnosis. It's an awful thing to happen. And we've definitely seen it happen before where the same cruciate ruptures again. Why isn't David Clifford nominated for Football of the Year? Asks Kieran Shannon. This is an interesting piece. Should David Clifford be nominated for Football of the Year? He calls him the Fossa Freak. He says he's the real MVP. So Lee Keegan, Conor Myler and Kieran McGeary.
McGeary. Yeah. It's interesting that those are the three. Actually, when you think
Dave
about
McIntyre
it.
Dave McIntyre probably thinks Kieran McGeary could still get nominated for Football of the Year. But
yeah, like it's interesting that those are the three nominated. I think it really kind of indicates where the All-Ireland was won and where the strength of the teams that had a say in the All-Ireland lie this year. That I know Keegan wore a cornerback's jersey on his back, but he played like a half-back when he was at his best. The two other boys, one's a half-back, one's a half-forward. That middle third is really being rewarded in the All-Stars this year, and certainly when it comes to the Footballer of the Year nominees. So I think it's on trend with the way football's been played that those are the three Footballer of the Year's nominees, and I don't disagree with the three of them at all. It's interesting that he says that David Clifford should be nominated. Like it's a good shout. He was so good against Tyrone in the hardest moment for the team this year. But before that Tyrone game, I think to put him ahead of his own brother would have been a bit of a reach.
Well, he's talking the league. He's including the league.
Yeah, and as it does get included in the real thing.
Yeah, you know, it's just it's hard to know because the league pits the best teams against each other, and so obviously it's our opportunity to judge them against top quality opposition. We did see how different a team Tyrone were when it came to preparing for the matches which allowed them to win the Sam Maguire than versus any other tournament. So what can you do? What can you do? Interesting piece from John Fogarty. Counties likely to stick than twist. This is his assessment of what's going to happen with Special Congress. He says it's going to be a talking shop. The idea of moving counties into other provinces to neatly synchronise the four is a dodo. Although the awareness created by proposal B in the media and accelerated by the GPA last week will give it a fighting chance. Nevertheless, unless there's a push of Rule 42 and black card proportions, these next 12 days it too will die a death and it will be a case of back to the future and the qualifiers returning for 2022. He talks about Brian McAvoy and the difficulties that Brian has expressed with regards to the finances, and he's got details here on the value of the qualifiers and the financial impact that the Super 8s had. And he said the fact that Pádraig Duffy was criticised, saying that it was financially motivated, the Super 8s. He dismissed the criticism as lazy and cynical. And in fairness, I think Tom Ryan, who was then the director of finance, backed that up. it will be an increase, but it's not going to be the bonanza that at first glance, looking at the number of games involved, we might have expected. So the Super 8s didn't end up in a huge surge in increase. In fact, I think they went down the first year. It's very difficult to know exactly what would have happened if the Super 8s had been constituted properly. The fact that Mayo didn't make them the first year, which obviously strips away, I don't know, is it 30,000 over the three games each on average? Is that what they would have got? Would they have got more? Would it have been 15,000 for the first one, 40,000 for the second one, and if they're still available, who knows?
Well, the last game, you remember, Kildare's last game, who would have replaced Mayo was in Killarney, and there was nobody really at that. And maybe Mayo have a win going into that game. That's a different thing. Mayo not being there is massive. Mayo and Dublin are the two most important counties when it comes to all these finances.
Yeah, so finance is not the premise that Ulster Chief Executive Brian McAvoy has based the majority of his arguments against the All-Ireland League, but he has provided an opposing view to Tom Parsons, who believes more championship games will mean more money. And I think, I don't know if it's in this piece or if it's in a different piece, where he's suggesting that ultimately what we're going to end up with is a provincial round robin. Ulster's GA support for round robin provincial championships, something that is not yet on the table but will be should both the All-Ireland League and provincial conference motions fail on Saturday week, is completely understandable. They would stand to make the most considering the strength of the competition as it stands. In the first 2 years of a round robin structure, Ulster's equivalent in hurling, the Munster Senior Hurling Championship, brought in 4 million and 4.2 million for each of the 11 games. In the previous, before they went to the round robin, they brought in 2.5 million and 1.9 million. So essentially they doubled their money by going to provincial round robins. Now, Ulster may well double their money by going to provincial round robins. Will Leinster double their money by going to provincial round robins? Is there going to be huge crowds watching all those matches where everybody knows the winner gets the right to be exterminated in public by the Dubs? Maybe there will, I don't know. And there's going to be loads of dead rubbers in those round robins.
What we need to remember here,
there will be dead rubbers in those round robins, because once you lose your first two games.
I think what we need to remember here is why we're having these conversations, and why do championship structures come up every single summer without fail? It's because of the provincial championships. It's because of the hockeying that Mayo handed out twice this summer. The brutality that Dublin have exacted on their Leinster rivals over the last 5 years. Not only are the provincial championships part of the problem, they kind of are the problem. They are the very genesis of the problem, certainly in 75% of the provincial championships. And this proposal would give the problem a greater airing. It would make the problem bigger. The Ulster Championship would be fantastic. The Ulster Championship is always fantastic. But make no mistake about this, this would make the problem bigger. It would make it more prominent. It would make a sore thumb stick out even more. Yes, it has worked so well for hurling, but there have been so many false equivalences between football and hurling made in this debate over the last little while. It's a different sport. It is completely different in the structure of it and where the power bases lie. It made sense for the provincial championships to go to a round robin in Munster and Leinster because you're making something bigger. You took a good thing and you made it bigger. That makes sense. What you're doing in Munster, Leinster and Connacht here is making a bad thing and making it bigger.
Yeah, and one other aspect of this is that actually, so at the moment, Kilkenny and Wexford and Galway are all competitive, but there is a scenario in 3 to 5 years' time where all of the best teams are in Munster, and you're going to end up with All-Ireland quarter finalists and semi finalists from a province who are going to get hammered. Like, there's a possibility, unless I mean maybe Kilkenny will never go away, but it's not guaranteed that the level of success that they're having at the moment will be sustained forever, and that the power base gets shifted. And so actually what Munster end up doing is some of the best teams are out and exiting the championship very early on. We've actually seen some really brilliant teams not get the opportunity to get out of their province. Anyway, I think everybody knows what we think, and there's a strong chance, unless you lobby your county board delegates, that they're going to vote in favour of the status quo, and everybody goes, oh, we need to fix it, but hang on, no, we don't.
But would this be a live option for 2022?
No. We'll have to go away and think about it.
Yeah.
As far as I know, we'll have to go away and think about it, and then we'll come up with this, which is another horse designed by committee.
Like, the thing is, what we're looking for, the whole objective is for a greater percentage of your championship games to be meaningful. Because, like, we're just wasting away time in the summer with the football championship. So if you're a team in Connacht or Leinster, you're going to have, if you're going all the way to the All-Ireland, you'll have five games in your province and then three games to win in All-Ireland. So that's eight games, the vast majority of which are provincial games. Whereas in Proposal B, the vast majority of your games are against teams of a similar standard. So it's judging geography versus standard here. And maybe that's a philosophical thing for a lot of people. Their standpoint is that GAA should always be based on geography. But I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is that needs to go out the window because it's just not good enough. Hurling is going to cream football again next year. And that's, like, I mean, it's fantastic that hurling is in such a good place. But all eyes are going to be on those two provincial championships next year. In the hurling, I should say.
The Daily Mail. Kenny Drive, Irish boss eyes win over Qatar for extra bounce and move to Axe Meath boss McEntee likely to fail. This is Michael Clifford. His piece says Andy McEntee's chances of staying on as Meath manager were boosted last night after it emerged he will need just 40% of the votes at tonight's county board meeting. Delegates from Meath's 59 clubs will be asked to either ratify last week's decision by the board's executive to sack him or back him at the meeting tonight. But he will need only 4 out of every 10 votes cast because of the executive's motion of no confidence needs 60% to get over the line. Right. I Can Wait. Ireland boss not worried about contract renewal. It's Paul Lennon's story in the back of the Star. Stephen Kenny is not focusing on whether his contract will be renewed as he looks to build on Saturday's World Cup qualifying win over Azerbaijan. Kickoff 7:45. Though, yeah, the special blue jersey getting worn tonight. He's been keen to stress that his side has been beaten just once in 7 games and he would love to make it 2 wins on the bounce. The FAI board meets late next month to decide if his deal should be renewed when it expires next July. I'm not really focusing on that when asked if he believes his side's recent run merits him staying in the post. Bruce calls tune, but not for long, says Steve Bruce, who sat through essentially an exit interview yesterday and then didn't exit. It was like, oh, so you're going to fire me? I'll take my money and, you know, however, I'll take it in NFTs, I'll take it however you want to pay me, guys. I'll take my money. But they didn't give him the money. That's what, I don't know. They're not going to cheapskate Steve Bruce, are they? They're going to give him the money they owe him, you hope.
Oh, I would like to think so. And Newcastle possibly not short in a pound or two.
Dillian, I want to come to Tyson's party. Dillian White has called on heavyweight king Tyson Fury by saying, let's get it on in a major fight for Britain. White will be in line for a crack at the WBC belt if he defends his interim title against Otto Wallen at the end of October. We'll talk about that in a few minutes' time with Ronan Mullen. The form factor, Kenny, Premiership or League One, I don't care, as long as you're playing well. Which, you know, if we have players playing well, better that they play at a higher level, but beggars can't be choosers at the moment. Kenny wraps Chio red tape. Ogbeni, long time coming. This is Neil O'Riordan's story, and I think it's the piece that Richie's written on otbsports.com as well. Stephen Kenny's hit out at the way in which Chidozie Ogbeni had to fight for his right to play for Ireland. Ogbeni made history in June when he came off the bench against Hungary, becoming the first African-born player to win a senior cap for Ireland. Obviously plays for Rotherham. And Kenny said, the thing with Chio is it was a long process to get him registered for us. The minute I got the job or before, we were trying to get him free to play, and it only happened just ahead of the summer window. It was only right. The process was with UEFA and FIFA having to trawl through records, which I didn't feel was right. He was living in Cork since he was 7. It's not like other sports where you can just change nationality. He grew up through the schoolboy system, came into Cork City, went to Limerick and moved in his 20s. For me, he should have been allowed to play for Ireland a long time ago, but he wasn't. We have a long process. So, an excellent impact made off the bench and maybe enough to get him to start tonight, but it depends on those other injury problems that we have. So, front page of the Irish Times sports section. Wisdom of the crowd indicates a belief in Ireland's new era. So, you would hope there'll be good atmosphere tonight and hopefully a win for the team. But Qatar aren't rubbish. That's the other thing. They are preparing for a World Cup and they're taking these matches pretty seriously. Ireland look for back-to-back wins in Montenegro. Ireland against Montenegro is on at 4:30 in Podgorica in the under-21. So if you want to see what the future looks like, you can have a look at that. And back page of The Guardian is Wales won last night in Estonia, so they're still dreaming of going to the World Cup. Will is with us. Will O'Callaghan, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Owen. Morning, Ger.
Welcome.
Thank you.
What's going on?
Yeah, look, I guess the news dominated by the fact the Republic of Ireland preparing for that match this evening, and Stephen Kenny says the side are progressing in the right direction despite missing out on qualification for the World Cup. They will face the 2022 host Qatar in a friendly later. Liverpool goalkeeper Caoimhín Kelleher, we know, is in line to start. Kenny's side recorded their first competitive win under his management, 3-0 against Azerbaijan at the weekend, and Kenny says he wants to build on that victory tonight.
So it's obviously been a long flight to get ready again, quick turnaround. So we're at home, and we'd like to get a home victory, but you know, at the same time, balance to see the big picture, hence Caoimhín's selection and so forth. I think but there won't be wholesale changes.
Well, Kelleher and striker Adam Ida are among the players in the squad not playing regularly for their clubs currently. And Ireland legend Kevin Kilbane was on Off the Ball last night. He says it's important for them to be getting first team action.
I could have moved to a team and been told that I'm not going to be a first team regular. I'm going to be someone that's going to be playing or a squad player for the first couple of years, and you're almost like work in progress. And I wanted the right thing said to me that I'm going to play games. And it's different now, don't get me wrong, it is very, very different, but that was the first thing that was in my mind, am I going to play? And that's the most important thing in my own mind, that's the way I was.
Ireland's under-21s continuing their European Championship qualifying campaign for the finals in 2023. Jim Crawford's side are unbeaten in Group F. They currently sit 3 points behind the leader Sweden ahead of their 4:30 start away to Montenegro. Ireland have their UK-based players available for this afternoon's match after travel restrictions between UK and Montenegro were relaxed at the weekend. A scrappy first half, key for more goal, helped Wales get their World Cup qualifying campaign back on track last night. Their 1-0 win away to Estonia keeps them level on points with second place Czech Republic in Group E. Northern Ireland really need to win in Sofia this evening. They're in Group C away to Bulgaria. Scotland can strengthen their grip on second place in their group with a win against the Faroe Islands, who were really poor at the weekend, while the Euro 2020 finalist England will host Hungary at Wembley. The second team qualified for the World Cup last evening, Germany, have joined the host Qatar. Now, Andy McEntee's future as Meath senior football manager will be decided by the clubs of the Royal County tonight. The county board executive narrowly voted against retaining the former All-Ireland club winning boss with Ballyboden for the 2022 season last week. A ballot of club delegates this evening will determine if he'll be staying in charge for a sixth campaign. Billy Sheehan will be put forward for ratification as Laois's next senior football manager next week. The Kerry native played for the Amours between 2005 and 2015. He was confirmed as the preferred candidate to succeed Mike Quirk overnight. Fellow former Laois forwards Chris Conway and Brian Beano MacDonald will both be part of Sheehan's backroom team as selectors. Seamus Cheddar Plunkett is set to be retained as senior hurling manager, with ex-Waterford boss Derek McGrath remaining as part of the minor management. He is down as a coach for the team next year. Cork will be searching for a new Camogie manager. It's after Paddy Murray stepped down last night after steering the Rebel County to 4 All-Ireland titles since he took over in 2012. He's now been heavily linked with the vacant Cork under-17 manager's position in the hurling for next year. Orgie Sneeman will miss another season after months confirmed he's re-ruptured his ACL. The South African forward has only recently returned from a year in the sidelines with a knee injury. And former Ireland winger Andrew Trimble, speaking on Off the Ball last night, says there's a mental battle ahead as he rehabs from another long-term injury.
From a Munster perspective, it's worse from them that they got a reminder of how good he is. You could see the impact he has in that pack. And you saw the try he scored against the Sharks, and he just looks so dominant. So it's frustrating from their point of view. They get a reminder of how good he is, and then someone snatches it away. But there's no novelty factor to this. He's just staring down a long, bleak, miserable corridor for a year. And this will really test him.
It's the end of his Ulster.
Sorry, it's the end of his contract as well. Obviously, that's the other thing that it completely leaves that scenario. Like, what does Munster do? What does Snyman do? Does he want to go back, spend a season in South Africa, re-establishing fitness? And I don't know. It's just a grim enough situation for everybody, really.
Yeah, especially when you consider the money that would have been on that contract too. Like, you feel for the player primarily, given that he's going to miss two seasons. But from Munster's point of view, it's a lot of money invested for what's only going to really be a couple of games on the pitch, realistically, before they go back into contract negotiations. Given what Johan van Graan said, though, yesterday with backing the player, you wouldn't be surprised if Munster try and keep him around. They'd be hoping he could kind of have the impact that Damian Dialande has had when he's actually been on the field. And okay, it's a sickener for Munster. It's a huge loss for the rest of their season as well. Ulster have got some better news, lads. Robert Balakoon set to make a timely return from injury. The winger has resumed full training after missing the province's last two matches with a groin issue. Balakoon made his Ireland debut in the summer. He was named in the training squad by Andy Farrell last month ahead of the Autumn Internationals. Also, Kieran Treadwell, Rob Little, Eric O'Sullivan and David O'Connor returning to training for Ulster this week. But Marty Moore is unlikely to play this weekend. He's following the return to play protocols, having sustained a concussion in training last week. Looks like good news on Andy Balburnie ahead of the Cricket World Cup. He has a foot injury, but x-rays have confirmed no serious damage. He'll be watching on as Ireland continue their World Cup preparations today when they play a friendly against Papua New Guinea in Abu Dhabi. Joe Gruden has stepped down as the head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders overnight too. He's been embroiled in controversy over a series of alleged inappropriate emails. The New York Times, the latest to report that they had discovered a series of messages from him with homophobic and misogynistic terms. There were also alleged racist emails which have been covered from 2011 by the Washington Post last week. Gruden says he's resigned because he didn't want to become a distraction and he's apologised overnight for any hurt caused. There's also a 7 race card at Punchestown this afternoon, lads. The first off there where the going is good at 1:15.
I hadn't seen that about Gruden. That's they were the Raiders, the Oakland Raiders, and they'd given him a 10-year, $100 million contract to take the team to Vegas. This was the first year that they'd been in Vegas where there were going to be fans, and they'd started the season really well. And then all of a sudden, the investigation into malpractice at the Washington football team, there were very, very few things that came public, even though that is a scandal-ridden organisation. But what did come out was emails that Gruden had sent somebody within that organisation, and they were the first ones that were leaked last week, where he used pejorative racial terms about the man who's in charge of the negotiations for the players' union. And so obviously somebody had a campaign against Gruden and decided that they had enough information here, and once the story continues to go, there's not much you can do. And I mean, maybe we've learned quite a lot about his character and what he's actually like. Because so for the previous decades, Gruden won a Super Bowl with Tampa Bay for the Glazers, and then became the most high-profile TV commentator. And they took him from the commentary box to make him this massive long-term deal. Huge contract, huge commitment. And so obviously walking away from that as opposed to being fired means that I suspect he's walking away from a huge amount of money. So obviously the allegations are serious. I haven't seen the ones that have emerged this morning yet. So that's a big story in American football. We might talk about that a little bit later. Will, just one thing you mentioned. I think you had a tweet about... you had a tweet about the Laois situation, and they love themselves a bit of Kerry in Laois.
They do. They swipe right for Kerry, it seems, every time. So since Mick O'Dwyer came to his post, I think it was in the winter of 2001, they've now had officially 6 Kerry managers once Billy Sheehan is rubber stamped next week. So it is definitely a way that they go, and it's on the back of Mike Quirk being in charge for the last couple of years. They know the Munster based coach and Peter Creedon before him, and a series of Kerry managers like Liam Kearns, who's been in charge recently of Laois too. But I guess, look, the thing to stress with Billy Sheehan is that he's been playing his club football around the place over the last few years, but primarily when he was a Laois footballer, he was playing with Emo within the Laois Championship, played for Laois for 10 years after he was attracted to play into Laois, having previously been involved in Kerry underage setups. But he's been developing a little bit of a coaching CV over the last few years, lads, between coaching clubs and then being involved with the Offaly coaching side of things. He was the football coach with Offaly 3 years ago. He was also involved with the Cork underage setup. I think he was involved with the under-20s 2 years ago. He's playing his club football in Cratlow currently, while his house is being reconstructed in Dublin. So he stayed active within the game along the way, and also he's been kind of working his coaching since about 2016 across various different posts. Seamus Cheddar Plunkett will stay in charge of the hurling team in Laois for next year after they retained their status in Division 1 of the National Hurling League. He has not announced his management team yet. It looks like there's going to be whole-scale changes from last season there, and intriguing to see who's going to be on their backroom team for next year, because Franny Ford, one of his management team, could well be one of the people that's in line for one of the management tickets, or maybe even the manager's job in Galway. So watch this space on that one, where he's not returned as part of the Laois management team for next year.
Right.
And Derek McGrath, interestingly, staying along with the Laois Minors as a coach for next year. He won't be the manager of the Laois Minor team, but he's going to stay on as a selector and their hurling coach. So that'll be his third season involved with the Laois Minor Hurlers.
What's the expectation around Laois football in terms of what might be achievable for them, considering that we're heading into a Leinster Championship and qualifier knockout scenario next season?
I would think if you were a Laois fan right now, you'd take someone's hand off to finish third from bottom in Division 3 of the National Football League for next year, because they're going to lose over the next couple of seasons a host of established players right down the centre of their team, like Mark Timmins. I think Colin Begley's going to be injured for the start of next year, but he's also advancing in years and a lot of miles on the clock. Kieran Lillis, their captain from last season, is also heading into his mid-30s. I think he's getting married over the Christmas period coming up too. Ross Munley's into his 39th year. I'm not sure if he's going to be staying around to play football next year. Maybe his former teammate Billy Sheehan can convince him to stay around, but there's a lot of work required down the middle of that Laois team, and some would argue that maybe the transition should have happened 3 or 4 years ago. So there's a real risk after Laois being relegated down to Division 3 last year that they could be one of those teams in danger of going down the trapdoor and going straight back down to Division 4. So I think Billy Sheehan's main task could be making sure they stay in the third flight for next season, and who knows what the implications might be for being in the third flight depending on what happens in Congress in a couple of weeks' time.
We shall see. Well, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Thanks, lads.
Will O'Callaghan there giving us his thoughts on the sports news of the day. Davey on the soccer that we were chatting about earlier on says, hopefully the boys get another good result tonight to keep the momentum going into November. Will says, has McLean played well recently? Did Sheehan just invent a narrative? McLean is not a good player. He is red card waiting to happen, says Barry.
Well, he has been red carded in the not too distant past, so can't really disagree with Barry there. Did I just invent a narrative, Will? I probably did. Did I just base it on one performance under Stephen Kenny?
Maybe I did, Will.
My short-term memory, as we all know on the show, sometimes just fails me.
Wasn't there a goal line clearance that prevented a definite goal in the previous game? Wasn't there, his teammates rallying around him? I think
McLean's been good recently.
His performance in the game the other night, that position suits him when there isn't a huge amount of defending on the turn required, and that was good. And the other thing is that the team looked a little bit like it was lacking the self-belief and the confidence to pass to each other in key moments. Having said that, right, it did feel a little bit like in the Portugal game we overplayed and we had some opportunities to shoot. So you got to be careful what you wish for. But certainly there was a few instances where we were taking shots on, and maybe they'd been encouraged to do so. Certainly the goals would suggest it. But a few more passes, square to Adamida, maybe we'll get a goal. And I thought there was that one aspect of McLean's play which maybe needed a bit of improvement. But that was one of his best performances for Ireland in a long time. Yeah. And if you're going to get good performances from players who are in the squad like that, that's exactly what you need over a qualifying campaign. There's no doubt James McLean will be in every squad if he's fit and playing club football all the way through to the next Euros, right? So having somebody who can come in and play left wing back, and you know exactly what your role is, you understand what it is, you're a professional, you might actually cause some trouble for the opposition, let's go, right?
And I think as well that he I know he's not fully fit, but he was picked over Enda Stevens the other night, which shows the trust that Stephen Kenny has in James McLean. We know the adoration that Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane had for him as well. And in fairness, he delivered big time in the World Cup qualification campaign, which eventually does end in huge disappointment in the playoff against Denmark. But I think he has shown down through the years that, yes, he's not been overly consistent, but no Irish player really has been over the last little while. And I just think in recent times, if we're judging it and getting very biased with the recency, then I think he's been good. And maybe I'm overstating it a tad, because his last game was his best game in a while, for sure. But no, I think that there's a reason why he keeps getting picked, and there's a reason why is he into the 80s caps-wise at this point? He's got a hell of a lot of them. Like one of the other points actually that Stephen Hunt made earlier on, just before we get to Ron, very, very quickly, is just his point about it was the first time in a while that Ireland were under counter-attack, and maybe Azerbaijan, having got the draw in Dublin, felt that they were going to beat Ireland on Saturday night. Maybe Azerbaijan completely underestimated the Republic of Ireland, and I wonder did that just play completely into Ireland's hands, and actually it's something that we need to take into account about how the game turned out so positively for Ireland.
Yeah, but I mean, Kev was saying last night on the football show, and we'll bring you that after 9:30 this morning, that we look good on the counter-attack, and ultimately that's the type of team we're going to be if we're going to make progress, if we're going to get to a tournament. We're going to be a counter-attacking team until we have a midfield of Roy Keane, Paul McGrath and Ronnie Whelan again. So,
well, tonight we might not be. Tonight we might actually have the lion's share of possession, which will be
very
interesting.
Sure, but in a tournament, right?
In a tournament. Yeah, it's just getting to the tournament is the problem.
It won't be either, because we're going to be third seeds at best and potentially worst in the next qualifying campaign.
We want to be 14.
There will be loads of teams who have the lion's share of possession against us, and that need not necessarily be a deal breaker. Like, you know,
it could have worked out fabulously against Portugal. Like, I mean, it could have been the counter-attacking sort of masterclass had that game actually, even for a 1-1 draw that night against Portugal, it could have been painted as such. So, yeah, it's definitely been the best version of Kenny we've seen.
One quick GA comment says, Mark, Dublin would be able to play those round-robin games in Parnell Park as demand would be so low. I think that is the truth, isn't it?
Yeah, and like, I mean, this would be no different to the round-robin games that would be played in Proposal B. The great thing is that they would just be the curtain raiser to the season with the added incentive of there being a little bit of excitement because it's the first games of the season. This is actually taking up summer months, and that is the issue that we're having.
I just can't believe we've got to the scenario that we're in where it looks like Plan B is going to be defeated. Anyway, 8:50 this morning. Ronan Mullen, good morning to you. How are you?
All good, lads. How are things?
My abiding memory from the second Fury-Wilder fight was the aftermath where Deontay Wilder blamed the very heavy robot suit that he wore into the ring for his tiredness and fatigue, and that was the reason that he lost the fight. It maybe there was something in that. He certainly put in a better performance in the third of the trilogy. Is that fair to say that actually he put in quite a brilliant performance, and that's what has driven this fight into the stratosphere in terms of how people are viewing it?
Yeah, I think if you look at his resume in terms of fighters he's actually beaten, it's fairly thin. And if anything, I'd say he probably gained more in defeat there at the weekend than he had in many of his title defenses, because, as you said, such a spirited effort. And off the back of a conclusive loss in the second fight, and, you know, trilogies are built on competition, the sense that it's a to-and-fro type dynamic. Like, Fury outboxed Wilder clearly in the first fight, destroyed him, outfought him in the second fight. So you're just figuring the third fight's going to follow a similar pattern. People would have noticed slight tweak in Wilder's tactics. In the first round, he probably threw more body shots than he threw in his whole career. But once Fury got on top, Wilder more or less reverted to type. And you kind of figured once Fury put him down in the third round, that's curtains. It's going to end around the midpoint and Fury's going to coast to another victory. But when the chips were down, Wilder pulled out that eraser and the right hand he threw to knock Fury down. It was obviously a bit of a delayed reaction, but he caught him right on the forehead, which is probably the sorest part of anyone's body to actually punch. And that just shows you the reverberations that Wilder was able to put through Fury's body, that it took him a couple of seconds almost to hit the deck. Then Fury went down again and you're thinking, geez, this is actually going to be an upset for the ages. But then I think you have to, as much as we're giving Wilder credit here, Fury's powers of recovery to basically come out after the fourth round and boss proceedings to the finish was incredible. And he's talking about being the best heavyweight of the era. I think that's irrefutable at this point. It's where we're going to like sort of lodge him in the all-time pantheon. And that's going to be an interesting case study once his career wraps up.
How technically impressive was the fight, Ronan? Because there's certainly no debate about the drama in the fight.
Yeah, I was saying to you a couple of weeks ago, obviously Usyk, Joshua, I really enjoyed that fight because it was high-level boxing in the heavyweight division, which is something you don't typically see. It's, you know, two Olympic gold medalists almost trying to outfence each other, and obviously a bit of brute force in there as well, given the weight that's in the ring. But the fight on Saturday night was more mania. It was the technique almost went out the window, but there were obviously key moments where Fury's almost peerless boxing skills you probably haven't seen in the heavyweight division before for a man of that size. That was ultimately the difference, where we talk about Wilder fatiguing, and this instance he fatigued a bit, number one because he was carrying more muscle than he typically would. He put on a bit of weight to try and live with Fury physically, which is probably a fool's errand in my opinion. Wilder should basically have gone to the party with what got him there, and he tweaked things up a bit too much in that regard. Then the other thing was Fury was making him miss so much, and boxers don't practice missing shots. And you can imagine Wilder's loading up, and like by the time he throws the shot, Fury's out of dodge. And that happened repeatedly and repeatedly. So that was borne out in the fact that Wilder was fatiguing in the latter half of the fight. So those were the little technical nuances that swayed the thing in Fury's favour. But in the end, it was ultimately Fury leaning on Wilder on the inside, a little bit of roughhouse tactics. The referee warned him a couple of times for putting him in a headlock and these kinds of things, but Fury was right on the edge in that department and ultimately closed the show in dramatic fashion. And those are the kind of showreel knockouts that heavyweight division is famous for, and I think that I think if anything, Fury's been a household name for a long time, but this, I think that win almost made him a crossover star. So it's going to be interesting to see how he's built from here.
Where do you put him in the pantheon at the moment? Where is he trending towards?
Yeah, it's just about hunger, really, isn't it? Because he walked away once before and you couldn't really blame him for walking away again, because short of Anthony Joshua, there aren't that many appealing fights left on the table. Like, that fight is obviously still appealing, would pack out any stadium in Britain and probably break every pay-per-view record known to man. But like, the intrigue as a competitive contest has probably dwindled, unless Joshua can somehow turn the tables on Usyk and that becomes a redemption arc and then that fight actually becomes massive again. But Fury went to, I think his most impressive win and maybe the most impressive win of this century is when Fury went to Germany and beat quote-unquote prime Vladimir Klitschko, certainly a dominant Klitschko at that time, in his own backyard as a rank underdog, like hadn't really boxed anyone to that level, and went and outboxed the best boxer of the era in his own backyard. So that kind of put him in that rarefied air. Obviously, it's well documented the gap in his career, the couple of years he took out and the way he's come back from that. And the first Wilder, I'm going to call it a win, it was ruled a draw, but he conclusively outboxed Wilder that first night. When he looked in bad condition, it looked like he took the fight way too soon. And on his worst night, he stifled probably the biggest puncher in the history of the heavyweight division, then beat him again, and then beat him again. So, like, it's pretty difficult to put these kinds of things in context in terms of all-time great trilogies, but it does feel like the bitter rivalry outside the ring. You mentioned the thing about the costume, but barbs back and forth, the insinuation that there was foul play, all these kinds of things, you know, kind of built it up, and you can actually see the 30 for 30 or whatever it is, it's going to get that kind of treatment in a few years when we get a bit of time and appreciate this was actually an all-time great fight that just went on. And then in broader context, the fact that Wilder put Fury down several times across the trilogy but wasn't able to get the job done.
So. Yeah. Did Fury benefit from the refereeing at the end of the second knockdown? I mean...
Yeah, I heard Andrea Ward making this point that it's a 10 count. That doesn't necessarily mean 10 seconds. It just means...
Why does it not mean 10 seconds? I don't understand.
I know,
that.
Like,
why does it not mean 10 seconds?
Because like, there should be a stopwatch at the side of the ring, but instead there's a referee outside the ring and starts the count immediately as soon as the fighter hits the canvas, and then the referee basically checks in with that guy and picks up the count from there.
Yeah, and then afterwards he's like, "Oh, we're going to wipe the gloves. Yeah. Come on, put your hands up, hurry up.
Let's get you to the bell." In that case, actually,
which is exactly what happens.
Yeah,
there was an instance where I think Wilder was. You're obviously supposed to go to a neutral corner as the aggressor in that instance. So the fighter who knocked the other fighter down has to go to a neutral corner rather than his own. Wilder was sort of ambling around, and the referee told him basically get back to the neutral corner, but then continued his count from where he was. So that was another maybe 2 or 3 seconds lost that Fury got to recoup. And that was obviously, much was made of that in the first fight, where I know lots of Wilder stands were putting up videos with stopwatches beside it, where the one where Fury did the Undertaker sit up after he looked like...
3.5 minutes later. It's like...
Yeah. So, no, there's definitely something in it, but I think in the grand scheme of things, Fury would have found a way to win the fight regardless, I think. Granted... If it happened so late in the round, if Wilder had another minute and Fury had to navigate that, it would have been a different story. But I think he is enough savvy to probably get to the bell in that situation.
Well, Owen was making the point that he would happily watch a fourth fight. Is there a way back for Wilder to get the I mean, you've already said that you think his standing has improved in defeat. Is there a way back for him to get the fourth fight? There's probably no point from Fury's perspective beyond the ridiculous amounts of money, and he says he's not motivated by money, but maybe at the end when he's beaten whatever else there is to beat, he decides that there is a cash-in fight, a fourth one.
Yeah, well, it seems like his ESPN deal is coming to a close, so he's obviously had this basically showreel spell in the States, so I presume once this ESPN deal runs out, he's going to have a homecoming fight in the UK, and we might get to it in a moment, but Dillian White is his mandatory challenger, so that seems like a no-brainer. Do that at Old Trafford. It's going to be a brilliant event. But in terms of Wilder, he's in his mid-30s now, which is not old for heavyweight by any means, but he's taken a lot of punishment in these last couple of fights, more punishment than he had in previously, where he would probably get outboxed a bit in other fights, but didn't take the sort of sustained beating that Fury was giving him. But there definitely is a route back for Wilder. He's a marquee attraction. It's just whether he has the hunger for it. And like the top five heavyweights at the moment, there's just a cool little round robin that could be done. You could put anyone in with anyone and it's gonna sell. And I mentioned the Floyd Mayweather impact on boxing of my generation or fans of this generation, that if you lose a fight, it seemed like, you know, the end of the world, but it's really not the case. Like, I remember myself and Owen did the Classic Game Club on La Motta against Sugar Ray Robinson. I think they fought six times. Mm. La Motta won one of them. But that doesn't mean there wasn't people weren't coming through the turnstiles in big numbers and watching that fight, because they just meshed so well. So to your point, I think Fury's probably thinking, been there, done that. But if Wilder can reposition himself to the top of the table, and he's really not that far from there, I could see it happening again for sure.
What's your order on that round robin then? Obviously, Tyson Fury's number one.
Yeah, well, I think the top four are probably beyond dispute at this point. So you're looking at Tyson Fury number one. You have to put Usyk number two. I'd still have probably Joshua number three, and then Wilder number four. But that three and four, it's pretty much up to yourself. As a bridging fighter who's really like been banging on the door for years at this point, Dillian White would be a strong number five. After that, the quality dips a little bit, and it's kind of who you're having yourself in terms of like Joseph Parker and Derek Chisora fighting at the end of the year. I don't think anyone would be putting them in that kind of echelon of top fighters, but they're the kind of lads who could move themselves back into a world title fight at least. But in terms of that top five, I think you can put anyone with anyone, and it's going to be intriguing. So hopefully Fury does stick around, and that's all borne out, because it'd be a shame if the Fury-Joshua fight passes by. Similarly, I think we all would love to see Joshua against Wilder be an absolute shootout. You just have to, there'd be no boiling the kettle in the middle of that fight. You just have to keep your eyes trained on it, because it could end at any moment with those punchers.
Dillian White, obviously, a lot of people will remember Alexander Povetkin knocking him out. White recovers to avenge that. Is White, is that just a waste of time for Tyson Fury, given how few fights he's going to have left at the end of his career? Or do you just do that and it's fine? It's, you know, maybe it's a 12-round slugfest and he just kind of leans on him for the 12 rounds and he just gets out. Or maybe he stops it 5 rounds in. I don't know. Like, if you're managing his career at this point and you're looking at the paydays and you're looking at history, do you need to take these fights?
Well, if I was advising Dillian White, for one, I would tell him he has a fight at the end of this month and there's absolutely nothing to be gained from it, because he's mandatory challenger, number one contender, nailed on, and we don't have to get into the politics of it, but it's taken him ages to get into this position where the fight has been ordered. You mentioned Povetkin. He was mandatory challenger then, took a fight against Povetkin that he didn't need to, got knocked back out and had to climb the ladder again. So something similar could happen against Otto Wallin later this month, which is, he's a decent operator and probably more of a challenge than White needs. I understand he doesn't want to jump in against Fury with so much inactivity, but if I was to, like, just maybe
pick up a niggle,
yeah, and just COVID. Box somebody in December.
I've got COVID. Yes.
Box a lower contender in December or something to get ready for the Fury fight in March or whatever it's going to be. To Fury's end, like, I think Fury has earned a bit of a step down in quality, and White isn't necessarily that. Like, I rate him as a boxer, he's just probably not on the level of a Tyson Fury, but who is really realistically at the moment.
They're terrible fights to take though, aren't they? Because you're like, oh, this guy's a little bit below me, I can not train as hard as I need to. Do you know, like, I can see the danger from Fury's perspective.
Yeah, like, probably looking down on White ever so slightly, but White is good enough to punish you for that as well. He's got a brilliant left hook and all these kinds of things, so he's very dangerous in these kinds of fights. I just think it'd be brilliant because White's an amazing talker, great salesman, and as I said, if you have that at Old Trafford, and Fury's been talking about fighting there, he's also been talking about fighting in the Aviva Stadium, as Phil mentioned there a few weeks ago, that Fury flagged that up, I think, after a Six Nations game a while back. That's probably not going to happen at this point, but I think Old Trafford, whereas Joshua has done amazing things in packing out stadiums in London and the Millennium Stadium and broken all sorts of gate receipts in the UK, Fury's probably never won that love from the UK public quite yet. He wasn't sold properly from the beginning. He had a bit of promotional mishaps, but now he's got the power of Top Rank, Bob Arum behind him. Frank Warren is promoting him as well. So I think it's only a matter of time before he comes back to the UK and gets that homecoming. And White, it's a no-brainer of an opponent, another UK fighter, and it would sell pretty easily, and I'm sure the likes of BT and Sky would be bidding big money for it.
Is there a chance Fury just walks away when we don't expect him to?
I think there is a good chance he could step away. I'm definitely not ruling that out, but you always get the sense with Fury that he could come back. Like, if he took a couple of years off and came back, won all the belts back again, I think that's very feasible. But he's so close to becoming an undisputed champion now. Like, all he has to do is beat Usyk, and then he's got all the belts, and that hasn't been done in such a long time. So he was so close to that before when he beat Klitschko and then gave up all the belts. So I can't see him foregoing that opportunity again. Like him against Usyk, on paper, you're probably thinking it's not the most enticing fight, but with that undisputed tag and the, you know, sort of spectacular ramifications of where that puts you in boxing history, if you can clear out the division, I think he probably would take that. But they obviously, Usyk has the Joshua fight to navigate. It's not a gimme by any means, but judging off his last performance, I think Usyk's a firm number two in this division. So one against two, you can't ask for better than that. And the heavyweight division, I think you'd have to say it's alive and well after the Klitschko stranglehold. They were two brilliant boxers, but didn't fight each other. And that kind of just had a bit of a stalemate for the best part of a decade. So at least now the lads are looking like they're keen to fight one another.
Yeah. Last one for me from this is the whole spectre of sports washing. It's been something we've been talking about on the show for a long, long period of time. It doesn't seem as if MTK's connections to Fury and Fury's public endorsement of Daniel Kinnan has had any impact on his ability to get or organise these big fights. It was a short story in the UK media for a period of time when the Panorama came out, but it seems not to have been mentioned in dispatches at all just recently.
No, it's true. And like the MTK thing, I think, is probably going to re-emerge to the fore because their emergence in boxing and their dominance within the sport is becoming more multifaceted. Like they've got more different strands that aren't necessarily under the MTK banner, which is almost a little bit more worrying that they're probably operating within the sport without sort of clear marketing or anything like that. The fact that basically no card goes by without some sort of MTK influence. And from the boxer's point of view, like lads in the UK are probably disassociated from the story, signed with MTK without really knowing the ins and outs of the whole thing. And MTK have just so much money to throw at the project that these guys are getting guaranteed money that they've never seen before. So from the boxer's point of view, it's understandable. The fact that journalists aren't calling it out in these instances, like I suppose in the grand, like the sweep up of the hype around the fight itself, you can kind of understand it. But in terms of broader context, the fact that it hasn't really been flagged whatsoever, given that Daniel Kinnan had been flagged specifically for brokering the Joshua Fury fight, which ultimately fell apart. I think, you know, it was pretty clear that he was still a central figure in the whole thing. And the fact that that fight fell apart doesn't mean that he wasn't key to making Wilder against Fury again. So, yeah, it's a bit disappointing probably that it hasn't garnered the sort of exposure that it did after the Panorama documentary. But as we've touched on the show before, like similarly with Newcastle, once Newcastle start signing Anthony Martial or Jesse Lingard, these kinds of guys, I can't imagine the Saudi Arabian stuff is going to be getting too much play in the UK media or the Newcastle media specifically. So it's one to keep an eye on. The MTK stuff's definitely not going away. And if anything, it's evolving in different areas. So I think the story will reemerge, but how soon it reemerges, we'll have to keep an eye on.
All right, we talked to Nicola Tallant on the show just recently. You can get that full interview on our YouTube channel. Of course, you can get it on our podcast network. Just subscribe to OTB Highlights. You'll get that. That's where you'll get this podcast or interview with Ronan as well. If you've just joined us, you missed it. We've been talking about the heavyweight division. Ronan, well, thanks very much for that. It's 8 minutes past nine this morning, and that is the best place to get all of our stuff these days is on the OTB Sports app. It is, 9 minutes past nine. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio between now and 7 o'clock tonight. So OTB Sports Radio is our full-service sports radio station. At 1 o'clock, it's the Life and Times of Johnny Caban. That's OTB Gold. The Dadcast at 3, Classic Game Club at 4 is Dublin versus Kerry from 01. OTB Gold is Barry Ryan talking about his cycling book The Ascent, and then the show is live with Joe from 7 tonight. We're back with Anthony Moyles after this.
OTB AM.
10 minutes past 9. If you want to get in touch this morning, we'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number, or of course you can always leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Now, time for us to turn our attention back to Gaelic football. I'm delighted to say Anthony Moyles is with us. Anthony, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning, Ger. How are you doing?
It looks like, from what we're seeing, that it would be a bit of a shock at this point if Meath did have a new manager next season. It looks like Andy McEntee only needs to get 40% support from the clubs. And we're told, I don't know if anybody's actually canvassed the clubs, that he should be able to get that support, which doesn't speak very well about the whole process and the whole scenario here. So all's not well, it seems, anyway, Anthony.
Yeah, it feels like two steps forward, three steps back a bit, Ger, over the last couple of weeks, you know, because
It's fair to say the county was on a bit of a high, I suppose, post the minors and the kind of the finishing off of the championships. Obviously, the ladies' success was massive for the county, and there was a really massive feel good factor around the county. You know, like, I mean, I was in there that day. I think I spoke to you lads about it. It's, you know, the outpouring of emotion in Croke Park that day by Meath fans of all gender, all age, all shape, all sizes was unbelievable. It just shows you how starved of success and the desire that's there. So I suppose when the county was feeling good, people outside the county, lots of people were saying to me, Jesus, you know, football at Meath football's on the up, you know, and it didn't come of any surprise because there's been a massive amount of work, obviously, that's been going on in the last kind of even 10 or 12 years behind the scenes in all codes, especially the underage codes, to start generating that success. But we end up finding ourselves then getting a hammer blow like last week. You know, and it's not necessarily a hammer blow just personally for Andy. It is, of course, and his management team. But it's, you know, it wouldn't matter if it was you, Ger, or if it was myself, or if it was someone else who was in the same position. The issues still arise, and you know, there are numerous issues, you know, with why we find ourselves in this situation with a management team essentially in the middle of October.
I didn't realise that even when you're in the middle of a supposed contract, and I know there's no contract because obviously there's no contract really worth the written thing that is actually written down, because obviously this is an amateur organisation and we understand that, but to have the vote at this point would suggest that the county board executive and the senior inter-county team aren't aligned, and like that just means that you're not going in the right direction. Somewhere along the way the relationship is broken down to a point where not everybody is aligned in the same way. And I you know, looking at all the managerial situations around the country, it's evident that whatever process the GAA executives around the country use to pick their managers isn't really fit for purpose.
Well, you've a number of, I think, like, apart from the very obvious thing, right, of how long it has taken, right? Meath were knocked out of the championship in July. It's now nearly the middle of October. Even if, you know, if Andy doesn't win the vote on his management team tonight, so an incumbent comes in. So this person comes in, has to basically meet the players, get the backroom team sorted, because I don't think there's a plan B, by the way. I think this was just throw the cards up in the air and let's see how they fall. We'll come back to that in a minute. But this person probably wouldn't get their ducks in a row until the middle of October, maybe the start of December. So you're not that far away from the start of the campaign. I haven't heard any dissenting voices from the players. I haven't heard anyone coming out. I didn't hear anything in the last few months to say that there was a movement against Andy and the team. I think people were quite happy with how things finished up, and I think the feeling was that Andy would and the management team would go again for another year at least. So, you know, the time to probably, you know, look at this was when a review would have happened to the management team, probably, you know, 2 to 3, 4 weeks after they were knocked out of the championship. That was the time to raise all of these concerns. And then that was the time to probably, you know, throw the feelers out there to say, well, actually, maybe there's another option. People can be disappointed with a management team. That's absolutely no problem. And I'm sure Andy will be grateful enough that if it does happen tonight and there's a vote against him, that he will step down. And, you know, the sun will rise tomorrow and there'll be a new management team in, and fair enough. But the way it's being done, Ger, is for me, the way it's happened essentially in this time, and the way it's just being thrown back to the clubs again is bad form. So you'd have to ask yourself, like, the vote was 8-7. So what exactly do the seven people, what's the issue? You know, is the issue performance? Is the issue that they feel that the team has stagnated? Is the issue that they feel that there should be a new management team? Or is it personal? Like, is there some kind of a vendetta going on in the background?
We don't know that. So, you know, again, that would be speculation. And in fairness, like, right. It was so close. It was on a knife edge. This wouldn't be, if one person had changed their mind, we'd never have heard about this, it seems.
Yeah.
So look, I don't know, maybe it's just opening the public's eye generally to what goes on. And one of the things that we kind of underrate is the stakeholder management is the way that the business speak world would talk about it. But like, you just think about what Andy McEntee's season is going to be like next year, where he's going to the county board saying, I need this money for this, and I need this money for this, and I need this money for this. And he's looking around the room and he's going, who here voted for me, who didn't vote for me. It's a very tricky situation for him either way now, isn't it?
It is a very, because, like, you know, as the CEO of any organization, you want the board of directors to be behind you. Now, sometimes, like in the old Premiership parlance, you don't want them to be behind you too much. Generally, when they're supporting you, you're gone the next day. But it's like the whole succession idea is very, very strong and is required now. I would always feel, you know, that they have someone in place, that Andy would have someone, be it that they're on his backroom team or that they're in the background waiting to take, they know the players, and that there's a relatively easy, you know, just a maneuver that they just come back in, they transition into the spot of the senior management. So that's one. But the second thing, as you quite rightly say, is where's the trust now? You know, so the trust between both the management, Andy himself, the manager, the management team, and also the players. You know, if the players are backing of Andy in the majority, like, where do they find, where's their trust level with the seven individuals or more potentially that are knocking around the executive and the different cohorts of the executive down in Navan? So, like, I mean, are they going in there thinking, this is great, it's all tickety-boo, we're all moving in the right direction, we all want the one thing? Well, certainly not. So, you know, like, I mean, Mike, like, what if Andy wins tonight? What if the clubs do vote him in? Like, what do those seven people who are on the executive do? Do they remain in their positions? Like, do they just say, oh, well, that's fine, but we threw the cat out of the bag for a little bit, but we're just going to stay here? Because obviously you would imagine tensions are going to be and relationships are going to be fraught there. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, you know, because it's look, the democratic process is can be often great, but it can be often absolutely very, very odd as well. And it just seems that this has come completely out of left field. I think everyone just expected that he'd be ratified, that he'd be getting ready for a new year. And it just throws the whole thing into disarray.
In Colm Keyes' piece in the Irish Independent today, Anthony, he talks about new underage structures being outlined in recent weeks and a new under-20 management pathway being mentioned / developed. I'm not sure where that is. What's your information on that and how positive a move that is for Meath?
Yeah, well, again, there's a couple of individuals who've been involved, John McCarthy and Cathal Brick, who've been involved in the minors and the under-20s in the last few years. Guys have been very successful with their teams. And it's good to see that there is a pathway. This is something that, you know, I would have called with you guys last year, where we were saying that the difference between the 17 and the 20-year-olds, that in Meath, you know, a lot of other counties were managing to keep these teams, and they were managing to keep a kind of a player kind of transition kind of period where they were going on to academy teams and different teams, and they were staying together, basically, and they were building those guys. They were bringing other fellas in who may have missed out at 17. Some fellas mightn't be developed. Some fellas mightn't have been taking it serious enough or whatever it was. But they were bringing players in and out, and they were trying to keep the funnel as wide as possible all the way up to under 20. I don't think it's any, you know, big surprise to anyone that Dublin are focusing over the last number of years on under 20. They see under 20 being the much more, I suppose, the barometer of if you can become a senior inter-county footballer is your ability in under 20 rather than at 17 or minor level, because you're physically developing. You know, you're mentally probably more attuned with it and ready for the battle of going into a senior panel. So the focus is a lot more there. And I think what was happening certainly in Meath was players were just being kind of thrown back to the wind, back out to their clubs. Some had very good clubs with very good setups, some not so good, and their development was dipping. So where if they were in a race and if they were neck and neck with Dublin or the other good teams, what would happen by the time 20 came along was they were taking a step back. So it was important that I suppose that pathway, to use a term that's been thrown around a lot, it was important that pathway was formalised and that it's been looked at. And that's all positive, Owen. You know, that's all very, very positive that's happening in the county. But I suppose then you have the top situation where you would feel, well, let's get that right and let's tick the boxes there at the very, very top, and let's make sure that everyone is, again, as I said, you know, we have a symbiotic relationship there. Everyone is feeling good about themselves. Everyone is focusing on moving on, and everyone is moving in the one direction. You're always going to get animosity. You're always going to get a little bit of people who disagree. But you know what? Disagree within your four walls. Go in, you know, leave blood on the wall if you want, but disagree, but then leave unified. You know, that's the way it should be. And this stuff that's going on, And again, happening out in the public domain isn't what you need for a county setup.
The one caveat to that is that if he does come through, like, our information is the players are largely in favour of him staying and that they feel that there's significant progress been made. The one caveat is that you do start the season with a chip on your shoulder collectively. You've got a shared unified purpose, and while it may feel like the enemy is within, you can definitely, you know, he's a charismatic enough kind of figure who should be able to turn this into an us versus the rest of the world scenario, and that can be a powerful thing, particularly in a sport like Gaelic football where you need to be physically at it from the get-go.
Yeah, well, you know, GAA loves a purpose. GAA players love a purpose. So, yeah, I suppose it could be used, Jer, but at the same time, there's probably nuances there that, you know, wouldn't be seen necessarily on the field. So you touched on it with regard to fundraising, with regard to funding, with regard to accessibility, maybe to resources that, you know, if you, I'm sure it won't be Andy, but part of his backroom team and some of the people who will be around him who would be involved in the whole funding of the team and the fundraising of the team. And, you know, you can imagine some of the relationships there where there's a lot of, you know, when training is finished, you know, on a Wednesday night or a Friday night, they're meeting to ask for certain things to get the green light. And that's where I could see tension. And that's where, you know, it won't be visible to the general fan on, you know, when they go in on a Saturday or a Sunday to watch me. But it could very easily come out in the performances because certain amount of teams may get whatever it is and Andy and his management team may be deprived of it because, as I said, there may be still fraught relationships there.
All right, let's move on to the other thing that we wanted to talk to you about, and this is the potential for a revolution in the football championship, which would give every single county meaningful games in summertime with access to their best players. That's on the table. The alternative is, we're hearing, and John Fogarty's in the Examiner today to give the credit to this, is that one of the potential outcomes will be it'll be status quo for this season, which means going back to the qualifiers, and that the next solution that we're going to be talking about will be round robins within the provinces. So that's what the future might hold for us. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think you just answered your own question, to be honest, because... Oh, I tried to leave this stuff behind me when the CPA finished because it makes blood come out of my ears and my eyeballs. But you guys have been doing an unbelievable job on it because I think a lot of people were very quiet on it. It actually amazed me how little was coming out of Croke Park. And when I started to join all the dots, Jer, the answer I got was one of the reasons why the CPA left the fixtures committee, which was they felt that the... it was just a Trojan horse to kind of basically get the status quo back in. And you know, I think it is. Plan A is that's not going to see the light of day. Plan B, and the funny thing is there's no vote for the status quo. So you either have Plan B, and if that doesn't get the 60%, boom, gone, you're back to the status quo. So I think John is right. I think it's going to be status quo for the next year. And I think then there's a review of the whole GAA Championship. And I think I listened to, is it Brian McAvoy week who was on with yourselves? And it was funny, it was a lot in that interview. It was a great interview, and fair play to him coming on and arguing the other side of it. But I think if you listen to it, you can actually pick out those little things that I think he let the, you know, some of the truths out. So in other words, a couple of things he said was, well, we let it all go back maybe after this to the CCC and let them come up with some ideas. I think that's where you're going, right? So the fixtures committee will probably be, it'll be like, thanks very much, lads, for your recommendations. But, you know, they didn't win. Sorry, we did try, you know, but it just didn't happen. So we're going back to the CCC, who have always been there. And what we're actually going to do is, and McAvoy also hinted at this, where he said, well, we're going to do round robins. Remember he said like 5-4 and Ulster, this and this.
Yeah, they've thought about it, yeah.
Yeah, so I think essentially that's the reason why. Like, I mean, if you remember Duffy went around the country, around it, and we were heavily involved in the CPA at that time, and he went around the country on the Super 8, literally visited every single county. Promises were made, maybe assurances were given, whatever it was, but he basically won over pretty much nearly every county to get the Super 8. And the Super 8 was a big change, you know, it really was, because change doesn't happen that often. You know, the split season, I suppose, so where the CPA have felt that the job is done for them with regard to their mandate, the split season, it only took a global pandemic to get that in, you know, and let's be honest, those things hopefully don't come around every couple of years. So let's hope it doesn't take another global pandemic to get the championship sorted out.
It's really, really interesting what you said there at the start, Anthony, your theory for why we might be left to the status quo. You think this is a Trojan horse for the status quo, because my theory might have been that this would be a Trojan horse for a different format altogether, maybe next year, that, you know, this just misses out by a couple of percent and then the next thing just stumbles over the line with a bit more of a focus from Croke Park. And it's interesting what you say, because maybe we're overlooking the new setup for the GAA strategic plan over the next 5 years, the committee that Pat Gilroy is heading up. Like, even just kind of looking through that, Larry McCarthy and Tom Ryan are both going to sit on this committee, and you'd wonder if they have a different plan, or if the strategic committee's work is going to involve potentially a different plan for how the football championship will operate over the next little while.
Well, you'd hope so, Owen. You'd hope so. Like, you know, you've got some forward-thinking individuals there. And I think, look, I you know, maybe I'm being a bit cynical about this, but I think the last year and a half has taught a lot of people a lot of things in that, you know, the old paradigm and what everyone was used to has been thrown out the window. It's not that it's a new normal, but I hate that phrase, but it's a situation where people realize that actually things can be done differently. Okay, you don't have to stay, you know, on the middle line. You can go a little bit left and right. And if the will is there, well, then it can be done. And that has been done. You know, things have been ripped up and thrown out, and things have been turned on their head, and new formats have been revised and developed up pretty much nearly overnight. So it can be done. You cannot come back into any room and say, oh, well, you know, it can't be done. Logistically, it can't be done. It can be done. So that has already been set. The next thing now is to try to develop a format, which is difficult. And like, I mean, everyone has to understand that it is difficult, but it has to tick the certain things that everyone wants. And the first people who should be looked after, essentially, are the players. So the players should be. The GPA is getting a lot of kudos, and quite rightly, but I still feel, you know, I went to Congress for my sins, and I sat there and I saw how the GPA were treated on the night, no more than the CPA. And, you know, if I was a member of the GPA once, and if I had seen then, you know, what I saw on that night, I'd be kind of going, why am I a member of this, really? Because they were essentially just, you know, left out in the waiting room. You know, they weren't really part of the situation. I would hope that it has developed since, and I hope that it will continue to develop, because at the end of the day, the game lives and dies on the demand and on the pleasure and on the want and the desire of the players to play the game. And that is it. You know, the quality, the requirements, all the dedication, everything that is increasing every year. And these guys will step away if there is not a meaningful situation to play. And then, you know what? They'll go back to their club and they'll say, I'm not playing camp.
That might actually be what people want, though. There's this kind of weird tension within the organisation where they want the big games and the big crowds in at the end of the year, but the rest of the year they don't really want to hear from the players, and they don't really want to hear about the sacrifices or any of that kind of stuff. It's like, no, hang on a second, you're club players, and we want you playing for the clubs. It's a definite tension, because I'm looking at the makeup of the strategic committee, and GPA don't get a mention. The makeup of the strategic plan steering group: Larry McCarthy, Tom Ryan, Rory Harvey, Conor McCarthy, Dr. Eilish Kelly, Pat Gilroy, Paul Foley, Professor David Hassan, Shane Flanagan, and Tim Murphy. I don't know, was David Hassan connected? I don't know. I don't think so. But
it's like, it feels that there are two different groups almost. Like the other strategic committee, the fixtures task force,
is done. It's finished.
Yeah,
it's finished,
so that's being wound up, and all of a sudden, then you have a different steering group that exists that includes arguably the two most powerful men in the GAA, the two men that we're wondering why aren't we hearing from. That, like, I wonder, is there other plans afoot that we don't know about? Like, but then it kind of like calls into question a couple of things. Like, for example, Anthony, I know this is maybe like a slight bit off topic, but have you heard one convincing argument against Proposal B in the debate over the last little while?
Not really, Owen. I haven't, yeah. But at the same time, I feel that I just feel that it's in there, and it's a kind of a thing whereby they're testing the water with it, right? So they're kind of saying to themselves, well, listen, we'll test the water with this. It's probably not that far from it. It is radical enough. So we'll see if there's any real demand for it. So if it gets maybe 20% or 25% or something like this, that I think would be a big win for it. Even 30% would be a massive win for it. So I like quite often the GAA, they throw out the flag, the flare goes up. The flare is just to draw your attention to it, to say, oh, okay, what's going on here? It's to start the debate in a very, very even, you know, kind of a pretty low level type of matter. But then the real debate happens post that. So, you know, put in another year. So from now on. So I honestly feel that that'll be done. The status quo will come in. But the real activity with regard to change will happen over the next year. You would hope, really hope, that steering committee can and has the bravery and has the backing, because, you know, to get some significant change in. Because I think you said it, Ger, on one of the things. Like my reading of Congress was, whatever is said at the top table, whatever is pretty much seconded and pushed on at the top table, just wins hands down. There's very, very little that ends up winning on the floor. If the top boys are saying it and they're pushing it, you're pretty much there. So that's what generally has to happen. And I think that's, you know, for something like that. And the CCC are doffing their cap to a number of people, you know, the Ulster Council. There's a lot of, I suppose, desire to keep situations as they are, because some, obviously, provinces would feel, well, listen, there's nothing wrong with our championship. We're making lots of money out of it. We're doing very well. The games are pretty competitive, da 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 da. So they feel that, you know, their little kind of province is where it's at, without really casting an eye on the game as a whole and on the actual future of Gaelic football as a whole, and on I suppose on the ramifications of the championship for fellas in different counties who only get to play really two meaningful matches a year in the championship. So there's a lot of things. I think bravery has to come into it. Of course it's going to be lopsided. There's still going to be the best strong counties, but you just want to bring in fairness, and you want in fellas that they want to actually play and try to get as many games as possible and try to enjoy it as much as possible and try to have something to go for. Because I don't believe this stuff of, you know, if you can't win Sam Maguire, you can't win anything. That's absolute BS. Like, I mean, you need to have something to aspire to. You need to have something to try to go for. And you know, all of the things that with the Talton Cup and the different things, that's all positive. So I think essentially what you're going to look at is, I'd be amazed if Plan B wins. I'd be more amazed if Plan A wins, but I'd be amazed if Plan B wins. So I think the status quo, and then I think the real work will need to start.
And that work, like, it's kind of like the present thought, that like that work would be benefited so much by having a look at one of these proposals in action, like especially proposal B. This steering group,
that's the thing,
would be so much better for the experience of working in an organisation that had proposal B, even in on a 1 year term.
This didn't work for these reasons, yeah. So we're tweaking it, and we now know that. So we've had the 20 years of the qualifiers, we had the 2 years of the Super 8s, we've had 2 years of this, and now we have all that information and we're spitting this into a computer, and out comes this fixture list that works for everybody. And but biggest, no.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
The biggest thing, Jer, is one of the things you look. A lot of this comes down to the old the finances at the end of the day, right? So a lot of it comes down to that. The GAA is bleeding now since for the last year and a half. So they went from a situation where they were absolutely, you know, one of their best years financially to having a nightmare situation. So they're now looking and going, right, how do we get revenue? How do we get ourselves back to that line that we were on, where we were growing incrementally every year? We took a big dip. So if you're a business, which they are, they're going to go back to probably what they know best. They're probably going to go back to, listen, we had a system there. It was making plenty of money for us. We had it down. Yeah, there was naysayers, da da da. But you know what? It was successful. So I would imagine that there's going to be a big push for that. To do something so radical after suffering a pretty significant loss for a period of time is going to take an awful lot of commitment, and it's very brave. So when you flip it and you actually think, well, hold on a second, if we did a year of this and we actually trialed it And we had a look at, well, actually, could we get the crowds in for those matches in the spring? Could we get some really, really big games that we, you know, we might get 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 at a league match, but we could we get 20, 25, 30,000 at some of these games in the spring in the provincial championships. And then we could get some absolute crackers all the way through the league format. This would be a time to do it because it essentially could provide them where they look at the bottom line at the end of the year and say, Jesus, this revenue has been, it far exceeds the best year we've ever had. And now we have the financial backing of a system. Never mind even the anecdotal stuff with regard to player welfare and games and da-da-da and enjoyment and entertainment for the public. But that, lads, is going to take an enormous leap of faith, and I just can't see it happening this year.
I think, unfortunately, you're right, and I think that this is death by committee. That's what's going to happen here, and the next strategic review committee will come out with their plans, and you know, I really wish that we still had Eugene McGee here because I'm sure he'd be able to dust down reports from the 60s and the 80s and we'd be like, oh look, this idea isn't new. This is exactly the same idea that we had a long time ago. And so, look, this is it though for us. I can't countenance talking about structures ever again after this. If this doesn't go through, that would be it.
I'm already broken.
I'll hold you to that, Jer.
Well, if anybody... If anybody ever hears me, turn it off. Turn me off. Turn the whole thing off. Anthony, good stuff. Thanks a million.
All right. Cheers, lad.
Anthony Moore has given us some thoughts there on the situation at hand. It's right there. This is right there. And even if it is only for a trial basis, we're gonna crunch the figures and we're gonna come back with maths that we think suggests that it's actually a no brainer from a mathematical financial perspective as well. But for me, the big thing is that those weaker counties can't keep their best players playing. They can't convince them to commit. Why would I commit to this? And that's the majority of counties. Most of the counties don't have a realistic opportunity to win any silverware. And what we're saying now is that there'll be meaningful opportunities to have a full season where you progress and you get access to the same strength and conditioning and you'll play in front of your home crowd and it will matter in good weather, and you have the same training calendar as everybody else.
You are allowed to participate. Like, that's what happens to the weaker counties. You are allowed to participate in the summer months. Peak time of the GA calendar is also for you, not just for the few.
OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. Subscribe to the Off The Wall YouTube channel and the OTBAM podcast. The best place to get all our stories is on the OTB Sports app. We have live commentary from the Aviva with Nathan and Stewie Byrne tonight. Kenny Cunningham's live in studio from 7:30 tomorrow, so you can keep your hot takes until Kenny joins us.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.